right. Ready on the left.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting, City of Arroyo Grande, for Tuesday, February 22nd. Roll call, please.
Council Board Member Dickens.
Here.
Council Board Member Guthrie.
Here.
Council Board Member Arnold.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Vice Chair Costello.
Here.
And Mayor Chair Ferrara.
Here. This evening, our flag salute is going to be led by Boy Scout Troop 26. And following the flag salute, if you would remain standing for our invocation that will be given this evening by Gene Bowser from Baha'i Faith. So, gentlemen, are you ready? Okay.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Tonight I've selected a prayer from the American Indians, which I think you'll find very appropriate for today. And I also will just note that the close relationship that you'll hear in this prayer.
So would you like to just tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, the thing that's coming up this summer is called the National Jamboree. Basically all the Boy Scouts in the nation go to one place in Washington, D.C., and guess what you have to do.
Last summer we went to the Florida National High Venture Sea Base, that was in Key West, and we basically went onto an island owned by the Boy Scouts for 6 days, and we swam with sharks, ate more fish, and
You swam with the sharks? Okay, just trying to get that straight. Who went in first?
This summer we also went to Cambodia, which is by Lake Peninsula, I believe, and we earned merit badges and had fun acting.
Do a lot of backpacking.
Yeah.
Take some of the trails around the area to various streams and mountain groups.
Good. Well, we really appreciate you being here this evening and leading us in the flag salute. So we'll look forward to seeing you again. So thank you. That takes us to item number 5, special presentations. We do have a very special one this evening, and I'm going to step down from the dais at this time. A couple of weeks ago, we gave our chief building inspector a royal send-off in this very room, and I made a determination at that time that that was not sufficient. So I convinced Larry to come back here this evening and get embarrassed one more time. But it's our way of, you can come up here, it's our way of extending appreciation not only for Larry Schmidt, but for the work that he's done over the course of the year or the years that you've spent with us, and I wanted to do this in front of the rest of the council and also our home audience. And Larry, it's my pleasure this evening to present a mayor's commendation on this 22nd day of February 2005 in recognition of outstanding service and contributions to the City of Arroyo Grande organization and community as building official with the City of Arroyo Grande. So Larry, it's my privilege to present this to you at this time. Thank you again for all of your years of service. We very much appreciated it, and would you like to say a few words?
Well, it was very easy. I mean, serving the people of this city has been a pleasure, it's been an honor, and it's had its own sort of gratitude that's come back to me every day I worked here. I don't regret a minute of it, but now that it's over, that's okay too. So And I'd like to thank my mother.
Larry has his sea bags packed, and he's headed for the sailboat right now, I think. Thanks again. That takes us to item 6, agenda review. Move that all resolutions and ordinances presented tonight be read in title only, and all further readings be waived.
So moved. Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. That takes us to item number 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for any member of the public to come forward and comment on items that are not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any formal action on matters that are not published on the agenda. We would ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes or less, and please address the council as a whole.
Gentlemen, Jerry Bunin, Government Affairs Director for the Home Builders Association. I've given Kelly letters for all five of you. It's a letter that we're giving to all the governments in San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County. It's official request that we be notified when you're going to raise your impact fees. And the law says we get 14 days advance notice and all the written material 10 days ahead of time. But the bottom line is that's not enough time for us to get busy business people to stop their work, read the documents, meet with your staff, ask questions, and then provide you written comments in advance of the meeting so you can actually know what our point of view might be. So what we're
I'd like to know when it will happen. And basically that's it. We're concerned, obviously. You can guess who it would be that would be negotiating that. So anyways, I'd appreciate that.
And we'll make sure that notifications go out for whatever process we're involved with. So
great. Thank you.
Thanks. Anyone else? Items not on this evening's agenda. Okay. No additional participants. We'll close public comment. And that will take us to item number 8. This is our consent agenda. This is normally a group of items that the council approves in one motion, unless there is an item on the consent agenda that a council member would like to pull for further discussion or clarification. What is the will of the council? Any items this evening?
I have none.
I do have one, 8C. Consideration of acceptance of easements, right-of-way, public improvements for 2207. Don, and I apologize, I saw this thing sort of late, and with the holiday didn't get an opportunity to go over this with you, but I did have a question on one of the maps. I'll find it here in a moment. Yeah, it's attachment 1. And my question is do you have it?
Yes.
Okay. My question is if we approve this acceptance of easement, does it in any way, shape, or form commit us to what is implied or inferred in this attachment, specifically the Castillo del Mar continuation into the county. It's drawn here as a continuation as opposed to a cul-de-sac.
That's correct. And it's, as you notice, there's a one-foot strip that is an easement strip for future access that prohibits any future continuation of that without the council's consideration.
Okay. So we're not acquiescing in any way by approving this with this attachment in the way that it's indicated?
Oh, absolutely not. No, this was specifically put there to protect the city from any kind of connection in the future without city council approval.
Okay. That was it. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, just for I was going to pull this item, but just for the council's review, I also asked staff about Lot 40, which is a in the conditions of approval, a potential road easement that could go across that lot. And my question to staff, and Don, you can respond, or Tim, in regards to we're not accepting this without prejudice, I believe that's the statement, so that if it were to be used for a future road extension to 101, that would still be available to us. Is that true, Don?
That's correct. There's an offer of dedication that's been made. We're rejecting the offer at this point, but the offer can be accepted any time in the future.
In the time frame for us to act on that, what kind of time frame do we get?
I don't believe there is a specific time frame. So as long as the offer is there, which it will be for a long time, the council has that option.
Not that I want to complicate things, but there is a process after 25 years where an adjacent property owner can seek to essentially erase the dedication. We'd get notice of that and at that point have an opportunity to accept it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, with that clarification, I'll entertain a motion for consent items 8A through 8F.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Things to read in there, Tim?
Mayor Farrar, there is one.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the City Council. This is an appeal of the Planning Commission's interpretation that auto part sales without installation services is not an allowed land use in the Gateway Mixed Use Zoning District. Community development staff sought this interpretation due to an ambiguity, tongue twister, in the newly adopted Gateway Mixed Use Zoning District. While reviewing a plot plan review application for an auto parts store without installation services to be located in the Town and Country Shopping Center at 1400 East Grand Avenue, it was discovered that while the GMU zoning district expressly prohibits auto parts sales with installation services, it does not address auto parts sales without installation services. On February 1st, the Planning Commission discussed the matter and provided an interpretation that auto parts sales without installation services is not an allowed use in the Gateway Mixed Use Zoning District, and that's based on the findings that are in the attached resolution. The recommendation is to deny the appeal and uphold the Planning Commission's interpretation. If you have any questions at this time, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there questions? I do have one clarification. And I don't know if you were, I think you were here, Rob, at the time that the first AutoZone application came through. Were you here then?
No, Mayor, I was not here then. I was representing a private developer.
Okay. Okay. I think I'll hold off on the question then until after we hear everything. Are there any other issues, questions on the staff report? Okay. If not, this is a public hearing, and we typically allow the applicant to go first. So now's the time.
Thank you for everybody's time this evening. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. My wife and I purchased this property approximately 2 years ago. And at that time, before we purchased, we were in escrow for about 6 months, and we had a search for various tenants for the property, as most of it was vacant at that time. And at this point, we've been able to fill most of the vacant spaces, but it has been very difficult to fill some of the back spaces, and we have looked for various tenants that might be appropriate for this use, and for one reason or another, over the last 2 years, a lot of them have fallen by the wayside. Before we purchased the property, there was a previous owner who had looked for tenants, and he had the property for approximately 2 years. So the building has been vacant now for 5 years, and we are looking actively, constantly for tenants, and this property has been marketed across the country at various real estate seminars through our real estate brokers and that, and we have tried alternates to auto parts, and for whatever reason, they don't find this site suitable. As a site for an auto parts retailer, this site sits approximately 200 to 300 feet from Grand and is an inline shopping center space, and therefore I don't feel it would be out of order to have something like this there. I don't think it's going to have a major impact on Grand or the city itself or the pedestrian use of this Grand entryway into the city. In fact, I think it'll be an improvement to have a major tenant, a credit tenant, who's going to be there and have a major logo out there. I think will bring a lot of people to the downtown area. I know recently there was a bank building that was built adjacent to our property where they have a four-lane drive-through, which doesn't seem to me to be consistent with a pedestrian use. However, if this is what the city's looking for, that's fine. In the previous discussions, when we had this last meeting, one of the concerns was the changing of oil in the parking lot. Currently, you can buy oil at Dollar Tree, Spencer's, Long's, the gas station out in front, and probably a number of other locations down there. So I don't feel that that is an objection that would somehow have a negative impact on this at this point. We have spent a lot of time and money with various other tenants trying to look for an appropriate way to fill in the retention basin and been unsuccessful in doing so. Spent a lot of time with Steve Adams and Rob negotiating with other owners in the center. And we are still willing and want to work on filling in that retention basin. We'd like to put a building down there if possible. If not, fill in the retention basin and make a grand entryway into that center and have something that's appealing to everybody here in the city. But at this point, because of the difficulties of the way the center is located and the amount of construction that's going on there, a number of retailers have discussions with AutoZone in the past, and they have indicated interest. However, we don't have a lease. We have no agreement with them. This is simply a change of use, I guess, so that we could pursue other automotive retailers. But there is no one that actually has any signed commitment with us. We have talked to AutoZone. They have expressed an interest. However, we have no definitive agreement. We have had definitive agreements with a number of other credit tenants who have signed leases with us, and then at the last minute, for whatever, have decided that they don't want to come. So just someone saying that they have an interest in being willing to sign a lease doesn't mean anything till you have the first check and they've done their TI improvements to the inside of that property.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other public comment on this item? Anyone else who would like to come forward and comment on 9A? No one? Okay. Then we will close the public hearing portion of 9A, bring this back to the council. With the council's permission, I think I'm gonna go ahead and kick this one off. And the main reason why is because of the issue that I began to address earlier. I couldn't quite recall, Rob, whether you were here or not, but some of the issues that the applicant raised came up earlier, and it was AutoZone that wanted to relocate across the street adjacent to Blockbuster and Grover. And the council at the time, when we denied that request, focused primarily on two issues. The first one the applicant alluded to, and that is the issue of service adjacent to the retail outlet. And I think it's important, at least from my standpoint, I certainly can't speak for my colleagues, but it was I found it ironic because I know you recall, Johan, the luncheon that we had. We discussed this at length, and the irony of it was that it was the next day that I drove by Cragen's, and there were two cars right outside of Cragen's with a hood up, people working under the hood. And so when we start looking at this, and the question that I was going to ask earlier, Rob, was I thought we had fixed this the first time around. I thought maybe we had caught up with the some of the changes along the gateway in particular and fixed the language. Apparently we did not. But from my standpoint, not just looking at Cragen, but looking at CarQuest and looking at some of the other auto parts stores in the Five Cities area, that's a common behavior. People will go into the auto parts store, they'll buy their part, they'll come right out, and they'll change it out in the parking lot. And there will be signs right there that prohibit that kind of activity, and they will do it anyway. It's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to regulate. So for that reason, we did not want to create that kind of an environment, particularly in our gateway sector. If you look, not today, today isn't a good day because the street is wet, the parking lots are wet, but if you drive by CarQuest, if you drive by Cragen's, you'll see huge oil spots in that parking lot. And, you know, a retailer is hard-pressed to go outside and tell their customers that they can't do something like that. They tell them they can't do it, and they're going to lose the customer. So that's that part of the dynamic. The other issue is the fact that, and this was brought up the first time, is that if we look within probably a linear mile, and we're not talking just about Rio Grande, we're also talking about Grover, but there's a line of auto parts stores. So when we start looking at the potential for generating retail sales tax, we have to look at an issue that I firmly believe in because I've seen examples of it in other business categories, and that's internal leakage. And our auto parts stores in the area are hanging on. They're doing okay. But you put one more competitor right in the middle of them, and it's not a question of generating new retail sales tax. It's a question of how much is being diverted from the other outlets. So I don't see a gain there. I think taking a step back and looking at the gateway sector and what our intent is and what we've been trying to do, we're trying to create an environment that welcomes me. And putting an auto parts store in that center is the last thing that I can see would work to accomplish that goal. So I'm going to support the Planning Commission's denial of this, and that's pretty much where I'm coming from. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I must admit, I've struggled with this. I met with the applicant. I understand the frustration that you've had filling the space. And what it really came down to for me was looking at the center and looking at the location and realizing that we are really truly trying to upgrade this area. And I believe that if we were to allow an auto parts store into the center, really what we'll be doing is pretty much sealing its fate. That we're going to accept that we don't want to see that upgraded. So while I do feel your frustration, obviously not financially, although for the city I think we do feel it also not having a retail establishment in there right now, I think it would be short-sighted to say let's do this just to pilfer from Grover Beach and possibly from some of the other stores in our area. So I too am going to uphold the Planning Commission's decision to deny.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Before I make my comments, I had a couple of questions for staff. If I could, Steve, the mayor talked about the Buxton's report. If you could give us an update as to where we're at with the Buxton study when we're looking at there's two questions. When that's going to be coming before the city, what kind of a time fashion, and it's whether there has been any communication with the applicant in regards to maybe some of the potential outcomes of the Buxton study.
Yes, thank you. The initial list, or a draft list, was prepared a couple weeks ago that we received, and we've been in ongoing conversations with Johan, so we did provide him a couple names off that list initially to help him maybe make some contacts with those businesses. This week we received a final list. The Buxton Company, they're currently preparing the final packets that will be sent out, the informational packets that will be sent out to each of those retailers. So that list will be, we just got that list, so we'll be sending it out to council, but then they'll be preparing the documents that will go out to each of those retailers. I think out of that list there was, and so I agree with everything the mayor said as far as we definitely will want to do anything we can to cooperate with the owner and try to utilize that to help benefit them. Out of the list we have, realistically, there's probably a handful that would be suitable for that particular size site. And out of that, I would say probably only two or three that that we felt were probably likely to go into that particular type space. A couple of those we've provided the names to Johan. He's made some contacts. However, they have not received this information from the Buxton Company yet, and so there may be still a chance for us to further convince those particular businesses to come here. So I think there's definitely an opportunity there. We'll follow up on it. Although at the same time, I have to say I'm not really optimistic based on just the list that we have, that there's a lot of opportunity there, but there could be a couple potential. And in addition to that, we have, on an ongoing basis, trying to work to also steer other potential retailers there. We had a meeting last week with somebody that we had shown the space to. We have a meeting with a potential retailer next week. So we have been working on an ongoing basis in addition to the Buxton Company study, but thus far, as they have, we haven't been successful.
Steve, when I was looking over this particular application, I was looking at it more from a land use standpoint, but through our discussion, there's been, in my mind, a talk about economic impact. And that's an area that I hadn't looked at or gave much thought to in regards to prior to this study. So I don't have the general plan in front of us. But what is our economic development plan? Do we have some conflicts with the potential of opening up more auto use in the Grand Avenue area and actually creating a disadvantage from an economic standpoint, as has been discussed? And I guess then my question would be, how many auto parts stores are already on Grand Avenue?
There's, as far as major auto parts stores, I believe there's two, one in Aurora Grande, one in Grover Beach. As far as specifically how our economic development strategy relates to this issue, I'd really have to go back in
years. We can put a lot of effort and time, but the reality is that there becomes an economic burden on both the city and the applicant at some point to get a tenant in there. Is there a time frame? I'd like it. Certainly, I'm not against looking at, and I was very supportive of the Buxton study. I think that was going to open up some. I was hopeful, and I'm still hopeful, that it may open up some opportunities and creates the appropriate demographics to work with some larger retailers that typically wouldn't come into the Grand Avenue area. But is there a way to put some sort of a time frame on this? If all else fails, this applicant is, I think, realistically having difficulties in filling this particular site. Once it's denied, it's denied.
Yeah, that's really a policy question. I think you can always propose some time limits. I can just tell you the whole business attraction process is you know, can be a lengthy one.
No.
It's hard for me to give you any kind of time, you know, estimated time, because some of these things we spend months and months, you know, I mean, you're aware of what we've been working with Big Five, and it took us like 2 years to convince them that this was a place they wanted to be, and then we weren't able to work out the project for them, so...
All right, thank you. Well, this was this item came before, and I was part of the council when this item came before us previously, when AutoZone was looking at locating in the Gateway section, basically across the street. And I was certainly opposed to that, and I was opposed to that based on the fact that it was a very prominent corner, and it really, because it was new development, and because we're looking at... trying to do some things with that new development, and I didn't think that was appropriate. This is a little bit difficult for me. I see this situation as being different. I see this situation as being inside an existing center, and although I do agree that it's probably not the best situation in regards to the applicants and so forth, in enhancing that area, I think we have an obligation to move forward with the applicant. I think he needs to have the ability to put something in there. So I cannot go along with the Planning Commission's denial, and I would uphold the applicant's appeal.
Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
Well, I think when we reviewed this, when we reviewed this back at the Planning Commission level, I think that we broke this out specifically with the concern about installation. There is no mention of auto parts retailing anywhere else. So I see the auto parts as just like any other retail activity. It certainly wouldn't be appropriate on the streetscape where we're attempting to develop a very specific pedestrian orientation. So I wouldn't support it there, and I think we probably should have it. Planning Commission level added that pedestrian notation there as well. I think there are two things to consider here. One is that when we do a mixed-use zone, pedestrian orientation is certainly part of that, but also part of that is providing the services immediately adjacent to as much residential, to the residential needs as we can. And one of those uses is, in fact, auto parts. I'll tell you, I spend more money at CarQuest than I do at the dollar store. So for me, an auto parts store is more valuable than a dollar store is. And I think to a number of people who live in this area may be as well. I also think we're on somewhat dangerous ground when we start to sort of micromanage the local economy. And I'll give you an example. We have 3 drugstores also in the Gateway section. I think we have 7 or 8 banks. So when we start looking at just trading dollars back and forth between different uses, I think we're starting to micromanage the local area of that, and I really do get on dangerous ground. So I could support locating an auto parts store, whether it's AutoZone or anyone, as long as it wasn't directly on the street, because I do believe that out on the street it would have a negative impact on the pedestrian orientation that we're trying to develop there. But when it's back inside the store zone, I think it would be an appropriate use, and I don't think it was the intention to ban car parts or car parts completely.
Okay, thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think it's important to go back and look at what are we looking at tonight, what are we ruling on. We're not ruling on whether or not an auto parts store is going to go into this specific location. Now, I want to read something real quickly here. Consideration of an appeal of the Planning Commission interpretation that auto parts sales without installation services is not an allowed use in the Gateway mixed-use GMU zoning district. What we're doing tonight is going to determine yes, it is an allowed use, or no, it's not for the Gateway mixed-use zone to be a use. However, I think we need to have a mechanism in place where, as Councilman Dickens brought forward, economics might be a part to play here, and as Councilman Guthrie mentioned, auto parts services does service the needs of the people that live nearby. I might be able to support making this a conditional use permit process where auto parts sales without installation would be subject to a conditional use approval process. I think that it's important that the gateway zone remain pedestrian friendly. We're looking at trying to upgrade this area. We're trying to develop more pedestrian friendly uses there. We're trying to set a theme and an appearance. And in general, on Grand Avenue, within this zone, an auto parts store, where we can't control the installation, could be a real problem. I don't know that there's a solution to enforcing the lack of installation process. As the mayor mentioned, if we leave that in the hands of the auto parts store, it's contrary to their best interest to go out and tell a client, no, you can't install that part. And if a client came in to buy a part and said, can I install this in my car right outside the shop right now? You're not going to say no. You're going to lose the sale. So I don't know that we can put this on the onus of the proprietor or the shop to police this. So this one, what I'm going to say is that I will uphold the Planning Commission's interpretation that it's not an allowed use in the zoning district, but I would support making it an allowed use subject to conditional use permit. And I wonder if there's a way that we can come back to policing the installation without having a police unit respond out there to tell someone cease and desist. Are there any mechanisms that we might be able to utilize to enforce this?
We actually discussed that amongst staff just in case, you know, the question came up of what we would feel the best way to do it would be, and there's, you know, one way is through some conditions, but you've cited all the difficulties in that. And it seemed to be probably the best way would actually be to do an ordinance prohibiting it, and that kind of deals with the issue also city-wide, not just with this project, because it is an issue we would want to discourage citywide at other auto places, and for a number of reasons, not just the unsightliness of it, but we also don't want oil getting in the parking lot that can get in the drainage system that gets into a whole other set of issues. So if you're asking what our recommendation would be for enforcement, it would be to establish an ordinance actually prohibiting it, and the police department would be the one to go out and cite them. We did discuss that with the police department. They're not objected to that. So,
okay. Well, I'd be interested in seeing staff come back with an ordinance to deal with this. And I might be amenable to some sort of language on this item that said that auto parts sales without installation is a permissible use subject to conditional use permit if not within 200 feet of Grand Avenue. Something like that. I could very much support that kind of language. I could very much support that. Those are my thoughts.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Mayor, if I could just point of clarification of Rob real quick. Can you explain to us what the PED, when we added a pedestrian, the PED notation to these, how exactly that plays out? I think that might actually satisfy Councilman Costello's concern there. I don't remember exactly what the language or whether there is language for that, but I do know that is specifically related to any building on a streetscape. So I wonder if you could clarify that for us.
I believe that the PED designation within the development code does indicate locations which should be reserved for pedestrian-oriented activity. And there was a definition in terms of a proportion of either frontage or distance from the frontage. I don't recall a specific dimension. We did, in the staff report, identify as an alternative the possibility of revising the development code amendment that the Planning Commission suggested to enable consideration of auto parts, whether it's by minor use permit or conditional use permit. That would be the second alternative that was outlined with the specific.
But And can I, and I guess a question for counsel, can we have language in this same motion that makes it a minor use permit with the pedestrian designation? Or do I have to make a separate motion for that?
You could do it all as a single motion and direct. I think what you're asking is you want staff to return with a development code amendment that allows the use subject to the constraints that you indicated, now within 200 feet of Grand Avenue, subject to a conditional use permit.
That's what I'm interested in, yes.
You could do that all as a part of one motion, essentially, uphold the Planning Commission's interpretation, but direct staff to return with a development code amendment that has the requisite CUP requirements. And I believe there's actually a designation in the code called the PED designation that pretty much, with some minor tweaking, let's see, what page is it on?
Attachment 2.
It's attachment 2.
Yeah,
right above
that.
The table. There's a, so yeah, if you directed staff to return with something of that nature.
And could I also ask that staff come back with an ordinance regarding installation of auto parts, as we discussed earlier?
Yes.
Okay, well, then let me try that. Let me try that and see if I can get the language out correctly. I'd move that we, in the matter of the appeal of the Planning Commission interpretation that auto parts sales without installation service is not an allowed use in the Gateway Mixed-Use Zoning District, that the council uphold the interpretation of the Planning Commission, and I direct staff to come back with language that would make auto part sales without installation subject to the minor use permit PED pedestrian designation, also subject to not being within 200 feet of Grand Avenue, and that staff also come back with an ordinance regarding the installation of auto parts on any locations in terms of any auto parts stores.
Did you want to restrict that to the Gateway Zone only, or I don't mean to.
I don't think that we should restrict that to the Gateway Zone. I believe we probably want to include that into. Let me find that section here.
We could come back with a recommendation on that. I'm thinking the highway segment probably would be treated differently, because that's actually the segment where we've been encouraging auto-related.
And we already have mixed use, in, minor use permit for that. Now, I'd like to see your recommendation on that.
Was that your motion?
That's my motion.
I have some discussion on the motion.
Okay. Well, I'll second.
Okay.
Can we second the motion? I'll second the motion, but with one clarification. Did you mean MUP or CUP with a P? You did say MUP.
I did say MUP because that was the designation that was in there on other pedestrian-oriented uses.
Okay. I'll support that, and I'll second that. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. I have some questions in the form of discussion. Rob, clarifying the fact that auto parts without installation are allowed in the highway on Grand Avenue. Is that correct?
Auto parts without installation?
Yes.
Yes, right.
And what about the, help me out here, what's the center section?
Fair Oaks.
Right. And
there are three sectors. What's the one in the middle?
Right, the Fair Oaks.
Fair Oaks, okay. Right. Is there a restriction in that area?
No, both of these districts, the Gateway Mixed Use and the Fair Oaks Mixed Use, require interpretation. At this stage, the only control that currently exists is auto vehicle parts sales with installation services. And in that instance, it is not a permitted use in the village districts, in the Gateway, in the Fair Oaks, and in the office mixed-use district. There is a lack of interpretation as it relates to auto parts without installation, and that's what we were trying to resolve. So okay. In this particular instance, there are redevelopment projects pending in the Gateway Mixed-Use District on the Tri-W Shopping Center and on the Briscoe Triangle. All of the other sites would be relatively small, but could contain mixed-use proposals. Most of those would front directly onto Grand and wouldn't meet the location criteria that's been suggested with a off-Grand location, unless they were more of a commercial development rather than mixed use.
Well, I'm looking at an ordinance that would come in, and I'm looking specifically, if we were to restrict it 200 feet off of Grand Avenue, in my mind, that would take into consideration Tri-W. If Tri-W decided during the development process or redevelopment process that they wanted to maintain an auto parts store there, it would be easily done. They could put another auto parts store there in the Gateway sector. Same thing with Briscoe and Grand. There's enough depth there so that they could do the same thing. Okay. I'm thinking up and down the Gateway sector, there are probably one or two additional locations where this ordinance might come into play. I can appreciate the fact that we're talking about frontage here, but we also have the potential to put in multiple locations 200 feet off of Grand Avenue into more mixed-use areas if this ordinance passes.
Certainly there would be other locations in the Fair Oaks mixed-use district that I would add to those which we just outlined. So there may be more than a handful, perhaps a dozen locations that might meet the location criteria.
Okay.
Mr. Mayor, if I may, just to clarify your question, and because you made an interesting point in regards to the center that's located on Elm in Grand, and we currently have Southern Auto Supply down there. If this ordinance doesn't go into play, and if Southern Auto Supply were to leave for a period of time, and then they were to want to come back and put an auto parts store there, this would not allow it. Is that correct? Without this ordinance. If we make this interpretation,
either the Planning Commission interpretation or the way it's outlined right now, if it's not more than 200 feet off of Grand Avenue, it would become legally nonconforming and could not be reestablished. Yes, this affects not only a proposed use and possible new developments, but also an existing use.
Any other discussion? Okay, we have a motion and a second. Roll call, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
I'm not sure how to vote on this. I agree with the first half. Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
No. Okay, that takes us to 9B, consideration of establishing a historic resources committee and a historic designation process for the city of Arroyo Grande.
Mayor, members of the council, I'll take the opportunity to introduce Andrew Burson, who is a planning intern with the Community Development Department. Andrew came in and followed Andrea Cook, who also as a planning intern helped formulate with ARC and Planning Commission guidance some consideration of a historic designation process. We are responding to a council direction approximately 2 years ago, and with that I will ask Andrew to give a brief overview of the item before you.
Just going to try to get this PowerPoint going first.
Welcome, Andrew, by the way.
Thank you.
If you will recall, there was controversy associated with a project at the east edge of the village on the Loomis property, and there has been a desire as a result of that project and as a result of design guidelines and standards attempting to identify historic resources within the community to create a local historic designation process. We have currently several structures and improvements within the city that are considered state or national resources. IOF Hall, the Swinging Bridge, and the Paulding House are the three principal examples of that process. And this city council has supported designation of those structures. We also have found that there is a potential qualifying structure in the Loomis House. On the former Loomis property, and that the setting of the house included the adjacent feed store. This is an effort to go beyond and to try and reflect the policies of the general plan towards historic preservation or conservation, and to establish a historic resource designation process. The ARC and the Planning Commission, after conferring with and obtaining the assistance from the South County Historical Society, recommended a specific process which would include creation of a historic resources committee. It was decided that rather than create a committee that would have the same powers or duties as an ARC or a planning commission, that this would be an advisory body assisting staff, the ARC, and the Planning Commission in developing criteria and evaluating resources within the community nominated either internally or externally. It would not necessarily require the support or nomination from the property owner, but any resource that was nominated, the property owner would be notified. The suggested process would basically include a recommendation to the Architectural Review Committee. The Architectural Review Committee would forward a recommendation to the Planning Commission, and the Planning Commission would hold a hearing before any resource would be designated. And if there is objection from the property owner, it would advance to the City Council for the decision of whether or not to designate a property. In addition to creating the process and the committee, we are trying to investigate other communities that have historic designation process and develop some specific incentives that would be encouragement to property owners for their properties to be designated. In many communities, just the prestige of being an identified historic resource is sufficient, and this is true in communities like Pacific Grove. In San Luis Obispo, they have actually instituted a Mills Act, which is a tax incentive similar to the Williamson Act for agricultural properties, and it basically applies to properties that the local jurisdiction considers to be historic resources, whether or not they fully qualify for state or national recognition. There are additional incentives in the form of case-by-case consideration of conservation building codes applying instead of the normal uniform building code. We think that these types of incentives and perhaps other incentives may come out of the process if we create a historic resources committee. Part of the initial responsibilities of the committee would be to try to update and expand the 1991 historic resources survey. Are we up and running?
We're getting there.
Okay. We will flash through as a summary of this verbal presentation the PowerPoint if it succeeds in coming up in time. I think the fundamental recommendation then is to get council direction. We are prepared to return with implementing ordinances. It appears that the most appropriate portion of the code to integrate these proposals into would be the development code, and therefore we would return to the Planning Commission for development code ordinance amendments and then bring that recommendation back to the City Council. In that process, we would also need to make an environmental determination to there's always the dilemma of if a older building exists on a site and the site is proposed for redevelopment, does that facility have any historic value in accordance with CEQA, and if so, an EIR may be needed to evaluate that. That was the dilemma that the Loomis property was confronted with when the EIR was required. It was principally to try and determine whether or not these structures were eligible for nomination in accordance with the state criteria. Is this still not functional? All right. If the council has any specific questions, we outlined in some detail in the staff report the five steps that we feel are appropriate. These include the creation of the HRC, which would be the initial step, and this could be accomplished by a City Council resolution and then appointments made. We have had some preliminary conversations with the South County Historical Society, and they have suggested four or five names that would be willing volunteers to assist. The principal person who I have contacted, in addition to Kirk Scott, is Gordon Bennett, and I do feel like Gordon is present, and I believe Jan Scott is present and could speak to the basic concept of creating an HRC. We do feel that they would be extremely valuable volunteers and might save the city $50,000 to $100,000 of professional consulting fees that could go along with trying to accelerate this 1991 historic resource survey expansion. There may be some consulting expenses associated with ultimately resolving questionable properties if initial surveys aren't clear or if someone nominates a structure that the city or the Historic Society doesn't have information about. We may still need to gather data. Other than the criteria and the nomination process, I think that the incentives will come as a part of the continued efforts of the Historic Resources Committee as recommendations to the ARC and the Planning Commission, both of which would be basically involved in the designation process subject to appeal to the council. If you have any questions of staff beyond the staff report or my brief presentation, I'd be happy to respond. We did include notes from the ARC and from the Planning Commission that dealt with the concept and several alternatives of whether or not to make the historic resources more of a decision-making body rather than an advisory body. And the direction from both the ARC and the Planning Commission was to encourage the basic step of an advisory body to assist staff, not to actually make a regular meeting and decisions on historic resources.
Are there questions for Rob?
Rob?
Yes.
The Mills Act that you talked about, the tax relief, does that require any kind of state approval of our program?
We certainly would need to conform to the state's requirements in terms of a local designation process and criteria. But in accordance with our initial conversations with the county tax assessor, no, it does not require a state designation. It would mean if it's locally recognized as a historic resource and the county tax collector believes that we're consistent in our interpretation of criteria, that he could apply the tax benefit of the Mills Act.
As far as the appointees to the committee, has there been any consideration whether there can be overlap between the ARC and the HRC as far as the members go, or would they be mutually exclusive on one or the other?
There certainly has not been any direction from either the ARC or the Historical Society. I think that there are members on the ARC who would be extremely well qualified to be on both. HRC, it would tend to create some complications if the ARC had a decision-making a level of authority, but they do not. They, too, are advisory. So they would serve at the pleasure of the council. There has been some discussion of additional design representatives or construction representatives that might be interested in serving on the HRC that aren't currently members of the ARC as well.
Thank you. That's all, Mr. Mayor.
Any other questions?
Mr. Mayor, thanks. I wanted to piggyback a little bit, Rob, and maybe it's a little premature, but I piggyback on Councilmember Arnold's question about the Mills Act. Being familiar with the Williamson Act, I know that the tax breaks that are given there via the city are actually reimbursed by the state. Is the Mills Act the same way?
I do not believe that there is a state program for Mills Act subventions, so this would be something that the city would need to support as an incentive. We can get into the degree of participation that might be required and the level if this is an incentive that carries forward through the HRC and the ARC's final recommendations.
Okay, great. Yeah, those are all my questions.
Any others? Okay. This is a public hearing. If there are members of the audience, perhaps specifically those that Rob mentioned, Jan and Gordon, would like to come forward and address this item, this would be an opportunity to do so. Or anyone else?
I believe in ladies first, but Jan asked me if I would go first. I'm Chuck Fellows. I live at 202 Canyon Way in Arroyo Grande. Pardon me. I just finished 4 years serving on the ARC, which was very interesting and a lot of fun, and I learned a lot there too. And I have the honor of being on the Planning Commission now for the last the last month. And I'm also chairman of Preserve the Village. And as most everyone here is aware, I'm sure, every time we send out a survey, 80% plus of the folks in the community say that we need to preserve the charm of the village and the character of the village and our historic resources, as well as other things such as agriculture. They talk about charm, character, atmosphere, and our historic resources are a large contributor, of course, to the charm and character and atmosphere of the village, and not just the commercial part of the village, but the residential part also. As you all know, too, I'm sure, we do have a 1991 survey. I think Rob mentioned it in his very thorough presentation. But that survey needs updating. The survey, though, even though it needs updating, was a big help to those on the ARC, and I think to those on the Planning Commission, the planning staff, and so on, in making decisions in the past about saving buildings that were important to us. The list needs updating. Before you can update the list, you need to get started with the Historic Resources Committee. I think it's been massaged quite a bit by the ARC and the Planning Commission, and Rob's presentation, plus I'm sure what you have in writing in front of you, gives you an awfully good background on the way it should be laid out. And we certainly, as you mentioned, have some great resources, human resources in town, with Gordon Bennett and lots of folks on the historic South County Historic Society. The neat thing about preserving the charm and character is it's not just something for the people who live in the community right now, but it also attracts visitors, and that helps support the mom and pops that have almost every business in the village. And without the mom and pops in the village, the businesses, we wouldn't have the charm and character, as we maybe go over after that into large corporation businesses and so on, which I think many people don't want. So anyhow, the village is a great place to live, a great place to visit, and I say get on with the HRC. It's a great idea. The time has come. It's been here for quite a while. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi there. I'm Jan Scott. I live at 520 Via Vaquero, and I'm here tonight as curator of South County Historical Society. I spend a lot of my time trying to make sure that the history of this area is recorded and preserved. But we have something more than just a history that we're locking into computers. We have assets. We have structures that are the physical embodiment of our history. If we lose those, the important ones, we're in trouble. The first thing that comes to mind, as Chuck said, is the village. It's beloved, and it's not only beloved as just a warm spot in our hearts, it provides a good economic base. Tourists love the village, and that helps us. We believe there are other structures around beyond the village, and including the village, that need protection, and the first step is identifying those structures. The idea of a committee to do that is perfect. The time for
Ms. Robles are have a name tag on the front door and whatever. And these are the things that I'm looking at to get something like that done here. I've got names of people that are in charge in various towns I'd like to meet with. And, of course, we're just getting the show on the road right now. So that's about all I have to say, except that Roy Grandy doesn't have the Victorian houses of the type that Paso Robles and San Luis have, but they still have their own special buildings here. And like on the Sanborn maps on the wall, going back before the turn of the century, it said Arroyo Grande's buildings are wood and cheaply built. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? No one else? Okay.
Good evening. Susan Flores, 529 East Branch. I'd like to think I live in a historic house. It was 100 years old last month. I was also involved with my children buying in Old Town Orange, which is the largest historic district in California. And so we went through a lot of painstaking things to keep it restored. They have very good guidelines. Even the termite people will work with putting the right siding on when they do repairs. So places like Briscoe, I've had siding milled and things like that to retain what I consider its value, its historic value. So my house is restored. It's the old part is remained old. The people in the 80s that put new stuff, I returned it to old by retrofitting old. I wouldn't mind helping out with this project. We are very much long overdue because a lot of homes have been changed every 20 years and they've lost the original personality that they have. They're covered up with stucco and things. And if we become a resource, people can learn to take off what was done 20 and 30 years ago and return their homes to their old state, which is pretty grand. And I guess that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, we will close the public hearing portion of this item and bring this back to council. Councilmember Dickens, why don't you start this one off for us?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This was something that I thought was very important a couple years ago to direct staff to bring back to us. And I'm pleased to see it here before us, and I'm really much in favor of seeing this move forward. And it looks like to me, Rob, that what we need to do at this particular point is the first step is to create or put together this historic resource committee. And that looks like it's got to come back in the form of a resolution and some sort of a mechanism as to what it is that their responsibilities will be and the tasks that will be set forth. So I see that as being the first step that that we need to do. I'm certainly in favor of that. And like to see that come back to us as soon as possible. I think we have some very qualified and very ambitious individuals out here that are willing to help staff. I think that's been part of our problem is being a small town, we don't have the staff availability to accommodate this particular, it's a large project. So, and I definitely understand that. But I think that we have some great folks out there that are willing to pitch in. I'm certainly in favor at this point of looking at this Historic Resource Committee as an advisory committee that can then make good quality recommendations, can do some research, and then bring those forth to the appropriate bodies for review. The second item that I think is critical that I'd like to see as one of the outcomes is the development of the criteria for a local designation of historic resources. That, to me, is a must. I think that we need to, I'll back up. The reason why I think it's a must is part of the problem that I had with the environmental review process when it came to the EC Loomis project is the fact that we did not have this criteria in place. And if we had, we wouldn't have had the difficulties and the resistance. I would rather be proactive in regards to identifying and recognizing those resources within our community that are considered historic. And I think that we need to have a local designation. Whether an individual wants to pursue state and national recognitions, it's a whole other ballgame. But we have some very unique situations and I think some great some benefits, possibly tax breaks and other options for people to move forward with the preservation and looking at local designation for their own historic resource. So I think those will be important, but I see the committee, I see staff, I see that there are all our other models out in the community already that will help us then put those in place, which will ultimately come, I'm assuming, back to us in another resolution or ordinance that we would have to then adopt. And so this is definitely a process, and I want to thank both staff, especially the interns, both Andrew and Andrea, I believe, who put this together. This is a very thorough report, and I appreciate all the information that you've put in here. It's a lot of research, and I think we've got a real good foundation for moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I'd like to also commend staff for a great job. I do believe that the HRC will be a very valuable resource for the city. One of the things when I was looking at with the development of the criteria and reading the different bulleted items, I might be a little concerned if we have meets one or more of the following. We might want to look at meets two or more or something. Some of those are very broad categories and could possibly have the entire city, if you or anything over 50 years, established as historic. So we might want to make sure that we don't apply it too broadly, or we're just going to have a lot of appeals and stuff like that. I think we really want to make sure that we do catch all the historic homes, but not all the homes, period, and on buildings in general. As far as under the nomination process, I also noticed in the second paragraph, basically, the nomination can be submitted by basically anyone, if you read the sixth item, or any organization. So I'm not sure if we need to spell it out that way, or if we want to try to limit it, or if we don't. The other thought that I have on the actual appointees is this is a very passionate topic for, I think, a lot of people in the city, and I don't think we necessarily want to limit it to five people. If we have more people that are willing to step up to the board and do a lot of the work so staff doesn't, I think we should have a mechanism for allowing them. So we might want to look at possibly two appointees per person, or half from council, half from staff. I think that since this is just strictly an advisory body, the more people that we can have out there doing the work, and this is going to be a lot of tedious work, and it'd probably end up being a lot more thorough if we have more people doing it. So, but I definitely wholeheartedly endorse going forward with this. I think it will take a lot of the question out of, if you are buying an old home, is it possibly historic or not? So therefore, if that's not a proposition that you wish to get involved in, you will know up front the possible expenses. At the same token, with the possibility of the Mills Act, which I think would be a very valuable tool, especially with the prices of real estate where they are and property taxes becoming more and more of a concern, that could be a great incentive for someone to want to restore a historic building. So I definitely think this will be a great asset to the city, and thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
Well, I too will echo everyone's thanks for the work that staff's put in here. Certainly, as with a lot of these projects, there's a lot of research that goes into it. For me, the key issue here to me is certainty. When we first reviewed these, I think that, as Councilman Dickens indicated, one of the biggest frustrations was the unknown of what was historic and what wasn't, and the interpretation of the developer that it wasn't historic, and the interpretation of the community that it was, but that there actually was no concrete way of determining that. And I think that this will go a long way to establishing that. And I think that's really the key of what we're looking forward to, is both certainty for a property owner to know exactly what they're dealing with, and also certainly certainty for our community, who will in fact know that our historic resources are protected. I will echo Councilman Arnold's idea here of expanding the committee. I do think ultimately you do have to have a decision-making process, but at least here in the beginning, I suggest that maybe we look at it as being more like the Housing Task Force was, that it would be more of an ad hoc committee in the beginning, since it's making at least an initial recommendation to the Architectural Review Board. Somewhere in the future, though, you do have to establish a group of people that are committed to coming back to reviewing future decisions. So I think maybe it's a combination of both, but at least in the beginning, I agree the more people, the more hands will make this work go a lot better. So I'm looking forward to this coming back as a firm resolution, and looking forward to
that they need to be notified, or shall be, whatever the language, just clean that up. We do need criteria for local designation of historic resources. There were problems in the past where structures were deemed by the community at large and the council as being historically significant, but not by the particular individual owner. And if we have clear-cut delineations as to what is and what is not, I think that's an extremely useful tool. So I think that's also important. There does need to be the review process. Point C, and I think that's also has to be there. And again, there's language in there about notification of nomination should be given to the owner of record. Again, should that's a must be given. Expansion and update of the 1991 Historical Research Survey, absolutely, that's critical also. Very much behind that, I think that needs to come forward. And the last one, point E, create incentives for historical preservation, restoration, and reuse. Also, I'm very intrigued by this Mills Act tax relief. I think that's going to be a useful tool. And anything else that we can do, any other measures that are possible as creating incentives or things we should explore. So I look forward to what staff can come up with and bring back to us that may make that a little bit more expansive. and will also be a useful tool for us as a community to offer to people that bring forward buildings and structures to try to get them designated as historic. So I very much support this, Mr. Mayor, and I think that all 5 points are important, and we need to go forward with all of them. Thank you.
Thank you. I, too, support the process that's outlined in the staff report. A quick observation with regard to the expansion of the committee. While I'm not opposed to that, there was some discussion as to whether this should be an ad hoc committee. I don't think I agree with that. I believe that that this committee should be a standing committee. It should have a regular membership. It should have a core membership, I should say. They should develop their own internal structure for conducting the meetings. But they could have an ad hoc element. And what I mean by that is that there would be the ability for the committee to bring in additional people. And I think it should be review-driven. If the nature of the issue at hand to be reviewed by the committee is such that it requires additional expertise, additional viewpoints, so on and so forth, then the core committee would have an opportunity to bring in additional memberships or additional members of the committee. They would be ad hoc. So I think this should be a fluid process, but I also feel as though the committee itself should be grounded with a core group, and the sooner we can do that, the better. But again, could in fact be fluid from the standpoint of allowing additional expertise to come in, additional viewpoints to be heard based on the nature of the review that's at hand. I like virtually all aspects of what you have here. I think the biggest issue, that the biggest plus that I see here is finally the ability to provide a voice that comes from the community and is not consultant-driven. I think many of us here recall in one form or another, depending on where we were, commission council-wise, some of the issues that came up around the Loomis property. And we had a consultant here that tried to tell us that that property and its surroundings was not historic. And we fortunately did not agree at the time, even though we were talking about a formal historic register. At that level, some of us felt completely different. So I'm grateful that we now have a mechanism and a process where we can internalize and make some of these evaluations ourselves. So I support all of this, and looking forward to getting started with the process as soon as possible. And I think maybe moving forward with that core membership and looking at who wants to volunteer, some of who are in the audience and spoke up tonight, and others as well. And then whatever process, however we can help the process in terms of appointments, whatever the case may be. So I'm looking forward to moving as rapidly as possible and getting this thing in place. Long overdue. Okay. Anything else on this item?
Okay, just ask, what do you guys think? What is the time frame that you think you could come back with with the committee?
We can return with the resolution regarding the committee as early as the next meeting of the City Council. The changes to the development code will require recycle through the Planning Commission and Environmental together, so that you can consider appropriate appointments and perhaps determine who the core committee might be, if that's the direction you go, rather than just the ad hoc. We will continue our close coordination with the Historical Society, which is very much appreciated in this whole process.
Okay. That sounds a little better.
Mr. Mayor, thanks. Can I ask just another clarification? Rob, is there anything else in your mind you need from the council to give you better direction as to put this together? Are there key points that would be helpful so when it does come back, you kind of have some questions already answered as part of the creation of this committee?
I think the recommendations of the Planning Commission and ARC are generally supported from my understanding of the council. we will certainly give the ability for the initial membership of the HRC to review their charges and duties, and if they feel that the process is inadequate or that they need reinforcements, they can certainly suggest additional changes. I think the principal concern was to get the committee up and operational so that we could start the survey work. The survey work will take a substantial amount of effort, and we feel like the volunteers are critical to the process. We won't have the staff to do it.
Thank you.
Can I add on to that? I would ask, there was a number of suggestions tonight for potential changes to the kind of the conceptual recommendations here. So I just wanted to ask, are those things that you want to make a motion on to give a specific direction, or would you like us to just take those back and come back and assess those and come back with our recommendations on each of those changes? Either way is fine with us. I just wanted to get clarification.
Is the latter okay?
Yes.
Yeah, the second thing you said. If you can maybe digress a bit on some of the issues that came up and then bring them back, we'll have a clearer picture.
Great.
Okay. With that, I'll entertain a motion. Don't all jump at once, sir.
Mr. Mayor, okay. I move that the staff go forward with the establishment of a Historic Resource Committee and with the designation process for the City of Rio Grande, including the development of criteria for local designations of historic resources, the establishment of a review process for designating historic resources for listing on a local register, the expansion and update of the 1991 Historical Resource Survey, and the creation of incentives for historic preservation, restoration, and reuse.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is there discussion? Okay, hearing none, roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Thank you.
And for those of you who missed the PowerPoint, we'll bring it back next time, too.
Probably with a request for another computer, right? Or is that ours? Okay, that takes us to 9C.
How's everybody doing? You want a break or charge ahead?
Okay. That takes us to 9C, consideration of a general plan amendment case number 04-003, housing element amendment.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. I'm going to try not to take as much time and find my PowerPoint up here.
No.
Huh?
I don't think it's not up.
Oh.
Can you put it on the hard drive? We lost it earlier.
You lost it?
Mm-hmm. I guess when it crashed. Yeah.
Would a 5-minute break help you?
I don't know. Would it?
Yes, it would.
Yes, it would.
Okay.
Thank you.
It would help me. Okay, the council is going to recess for, let's make it 7 minutes, come back at 5 to the hour.
Sites inventory, or as you know it as Table 15, through a tiered density framework and supplemental sites, updating the city's mixed-use districts to allow higher densities, reducing governmental constraints for disabled persons, strengthening the city's commitment for farm worker housing, tightening of schedules for implementation of particular goals and policies, and then basic cleanup. Council was favorable of these proposed changes, except for the inclusion of certain properties within the housing opportunity sites inventory and projected densities. Table 15 has since been amended to exclude sites that are considered problematic for developing within the housing element timeframe. After further back and forth discussions with HCD in October and November, the city was able to demonstrate that a sufficient land inventory exists to meet the city's regional housing needs allocation based on existing land use and zoning, and HCD determined that the proposed revisions are in full compliance with housing element law and would certify the city's housing element following city adoption and resubmittal. So that is where we are today. Additional changes and clarifications are proposed based on HCD discussions and new state law. Proposed amendments are to the city's inclusionary housing program, affordability restrictions for projects located within the city's redevelopment area, and allowable density bonuses. To summarize, the city's inclusionary housing program is amended to clarify the affordability restriction for very low, low, and moderate income levels, depending on the number of residential units involved in a particular project. So, for example, a project that is not within the RDA or already exempt due to other factors, it must either reserve 15% of the units as affordable to moderate income families, or 10% to low income families, or 6% to very low income families. And then some equivalent combination is also allowable. These percentages are based on the actual cost difference of providing units at different income level restrictions. That is, a project with a 15% restriction for moderate income units compared to a 6% restriction for very low income units should be the same cost to the developer or property owner. The inclusionary program previously had a 10% requirement, as you may recall, and did not differentiate between very low, low, and moderate income restrictions. Regarding affordability restrictions required for projects located within the redevelopment agency area, a policy has been added stating that, as you can see on the slide, I hope, yes, the city shall assure that at least 15% of all units constructed within the RDA project area shall be affordable units, and at least 40% of those are restricted for very low income. In order to meet this requirement, the city may require, on a case-by-case basis, projects within the RDA to include a specific number of very low-income units. Now, this new policy adheres to state redevelopment law and also to the city's recently adopted 5-year implementation plan. The purpose is to allow some flexibility of affordable housing requirements within the RDA if it is evident that the aggregate amount of existing affordable housing within the RDA exceeds state requirements. SB 1818. The staff report identifies a brief summary of SB 1818, which just took effect at the beginning of the year. Essentially, the new law increased incentives required by the state for the construction of affordable housing units. As a summary, the table on the screen shows the range of density bonuses that are required based on the income targeted and percentage of affordable units of a project. Our staff, as well as other organizations, has not been able to fully assess or interpret the full impact of this law. In addition, it is extremely complex. As a result, there are already varying interpretations to many of the requirements. Probably the most complicated are the provisions regarding concessions that must be offered in certain circumstances. Staff proposes that we further study the legislation over the NEC requirements at that time. To ensure city complies with SB, all previous reference to density bonuses have been removed in the housing element, and a blanket policy has been addressed that states the following. The city shall modify the affordable housing and density bonus provisions of the municipal code to implement the adopted housing element amendments in SB 1818, subject to environmental constraints per CEQA. Jerry Rio is in the audience today. He is from the San Luis Obispo County Housing Trust, and he's here tonight to address specific questions regarding the new legislation if needed. Once the housing element is certified, staff intends to discuss implementation of the new law in more detail with other local jurisdictions. That would be probably sometime in April. Staff then intends to bring back a revised affordable housing ordinance consistent with the new legislation. So with that, staff recommends that council receive public comment on the proposed changes to the housing element and then adopt a resolution approving General Plan Amendment 04003. And I'd be happy to try and answer some questions if you have some.
All right. Are there questions? Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Kelly, I've got a lot of questions you may not be able to answer now, and that's okay as long as I get them asked and we come up with the answers later. And I think I'll just go back to the easiest way is probably to just go to the text of SB 1818, which generates a lot of the questions I had. As I understand it, this bill, and it says it, is imposing state mandate and local programs with no funding. Okay. Page 2 of the Act, Section 165915, says that all cities, counties, or cities and counties shall adopt an ordinance that specifies how compliance with this section will be implemented. Is that the ordinance we're dealing with today, or is that something you're going to come back with later?
Later.
Okay. Going down a little bit lower on the same page, under 4C1, the city shall ensure continued affordability of all lower-income density bonus units for 30 years or a longer period of time if required by the construction or mortgage financing assistance program, mortgage insurance program, or rental subsidy program. Does this mean we're guaranteeing these units are going to stay affordable? Is the city going to have to back this?
As we do now, the city would impose the restrictions that require them maintain affordable.
Yeah, we'd impose restrictions, but is that what this says? Or it says the city shall ensure continued affordability? Is imposing the restrictions meet with the...
That's how I interpret it. It's no different than what we have in place now.
Okay. Concessions and incentives. If I read this correctly, we may have to provide up to 3 concessions or incentives. And as long as if it affects public health and safety or physical environment or any real property listed in the California Register of Historical Resources, then we don't have to provide the incentives. But other than that, we may have to provide multiple incentives. Now, is the definition of that, is each incentive an exception to our development code?
Do you want me to try to answer that?
Yeah.
I think it depends on the nature of the incentive, but if it was, say, a deviation from a side yard setback, yes.
So that's one?
That would be one concession.
So we'd have to give more than one for some of these
deviation
things.
From parking standards would be another.
Well, parking standards. I'm glad you brought that up.
That's Kelly's specialty.
Jumping ahead to that, it says here that, let me find that. That one was kind of disturbing to me. I guess that's on page 9 of the law, P1. It talks about 0 to 1 bedrooms, 1 on-site. So
And then at the top of this, it says, upon the request of the developer, no city, county, or city and county shall require a vehicle parking ratio inclusive of handicapped and guest parking of a development meeting the criteria of subdivision B that exceeds the following ratios. So this is going to impose these ratios on us. What we have, we have to comply with this. Now, is that on the request of a developer on any project or just a project that includes
density bonus? It actually relates back to subdivision B, which is the density bonus section. So if they offer up very low, low, or moderate income units.
I did not catch that. Appreciate that. And then I guess I'm going to ask a general question, and maybe you're going to answer this in the course. Exactly how do all of these different ratios and percentages come into play, and what do they really mean? Later. Okay. That's all for now.
Any other questions in the staff report? I do have one question, just sort of a broad question, Kelly, on SB 1818. You indicated that you're going to take it back and try and digest it. Let me make a suggestion that you may want to check with the League of Cities and see what has come out of their housing task force on SB 1818. And then also, since the most recent, and I mentioned this before, since the most recent general government report coming out of the Ledge Analyst's office pretty much declared the original housing legislation to be an unfunded state mandate and recommended that they do away with it, or at least not renew it at the next cycle, change it. I see the same characteristics with regard to an unfunded state mandate alive and well in SB 1818, which leads me to believe that there are court challenges on the horizon. When we start talking about particularly concessions and incentives here, the way this reads, I'm certainly, I guess in your research, you need to, I guess, approach this and with that in mind. Certainly, there are other factors as well, but I just wanted to, before I forget, I wanted to mention that. Okay. If there are no other questions or comments on the staff report, then this is a public hearing. Any member of the audience that would like to come forward, this would be an opportunity for you to do so on this item.
I think that was funny. You get the short straw.
Good evening, Mayor Ferreira and members of the council. I'm Jerry Ryu from the Housing Trust Fund. I'm here basically to encourage you to adopt the housing element today, the amendments, and to have a certified housing element so that you can qualify for certain state housing program funds, and also to protect yourself from potential lawsuits for not having an adequate general plan. And then to give staff time to work on the ordinances that would implement the plan. At that point, you'll be able to look at the specific programs and how they would impact development in the community, and that's the time to go over the details. I'm also available for questions if you have any related to the issues that were discussed today.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Jerry Bunin, Government Affairs Director for the Home Builders Association. And while I agree SB 1818 is complicated, I've been through it about four or five times with state HCD. And let me show you what I think some of their interpretations of what's in this ordinance are. If you have land right now in the city that's zoned for 6 to 10 units per acre, and a builder voluntarily agrees to comply with SB 1818, he's guaranteed, he or she, 10 units per acre. If they give you 5% very low, 10% low, or 15% moderate, they're entitled to a 20% density bonus for the first two and 10% for the last one. So on a 10-unit project that was had 5% very low, or one unit, let me let's do 10% low. One unit that's very low, they're going to guarantee that that project is now 12 units. One of them is affordable, very low. I'm very, very certain that's the way this works. You actually wind up with very little leeway under the way the law is written in terms of what you can and cannot do to it, because the law says you shall do this. Whether you want to call that an unfunded mandate or not, the law is very clear on that, and I think HCD agrees that that's what the law says. When I talked to Rob and Kelly, I was talking to them about some things other communities have done to deal with SB 1818, which was not something the building industry pushed in Sacramento. It was, although we think it's a good law, and it's an actually what it does is modify the existing law. It was actually supported by affordable housing advocates who were the ones who pushed this. We didn't even know it was on the radar screen until it was almost approved. We think that worked very well. So go back to the 10-unit project. So now we have a 12-unit project. We've got one low, one very low, and two extra units. On the same basic size property that you had for 10, you now have 12. The builders still want to do a good project. They still want to have their buyers to be very happy with what they have and to tell everyone these guys do good work. So instead of coming up with trying to squeeze 12 large custom homes on the site, the builder is going to resort to what we call as affordability by design, and they're going to do a lot of those units are going to be smaller. Instead of doing a 2,500-square-foot home, they're going to do a 1,500-square-foot home. They might do four or six of those. And they're going to sell for a lot less than you would for a large single-family home. So what you've done is you've created a money supply for low and very low, two affordable units that are price-restricted, and probably four more that are not price-restricted that are going to sell for moderate-income housing. That's just an example of what somebody else did with it. Every builder will tell you, I'm sure it complied with RDA law, but I don't think it complies with reality. Builders who have to do with 15% has to be affordable, and then 40% has to be very low, is that what I remember? So that would, I'm mathematically impaired, but I believe that means I'm doing six very low units. That's about a $300,000 subsidy per unit. For your homes are selling for in the vicinity of about $550,000, $575,000. We could sell those units for about $200,000, so that's about a $375,000, $350,000 subsidy. That is going to make the market rate units just go through the roof. People, I don't think people understand how profit works in housing, and then I'll wrap up. I know I exceeded my 3 minutes. If you have a 50-unit project, the landowner, the investor, and the banker are the first 45 units. They're going to get their profit regardless. The bank isn't going to fund the project out of the goodness of its heart. It's going to want it 15%. The builder is the last 5%. Somebody has to absorb all of that cost for subsidizing the affordable unit. It's going to be the buyer. And if the market turns sour, which it could easily do in 5 years from when these projects go forward, you're going to wind up with nothing. So it might comply with RDA law. It's not going to produce you very much affordable housing. And I don't think that any builder will use your inclusionary housing program, because they can go to the state density bonus program, get lower percentage requirements of affordable units, and get a higher density bonus program, higher density bonus that you will not be able to say no to. So I would suggest that you come back with an alternative that has a different incentive that actually appeals to builders. So thank you very much. I really appreciate letting me ramble longer than 3 minutes.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Hi, I'm Jane Sadek, and I'm purchasing property at 1136 Grand. And this is all very confusing, isn't it? Because of this transaction, I'm trying to familiarize myself with the housing element document that you were discussing tonight. I want to thank the staff for the amount of work that must have gone into such a long and complex document, especially when there are so many types of entities like the state, residents, and developers that must be satisfied. I do have a few comments, however. With the changes in that this Senate Bill 1818 brings on, it does raise questions that may have to be answered later on. And with what you're doing here, it's just very, very, very strict. Projects in the past only had to have nine. They had to have nine units before you would have to do low-income housing, and now that's been lowered to six. That includes a whole lot more builders and a lot more projects that may go other places. Also, though everybody agrees that we need more affordable housing, current projects like Jasmine Place are having difficulty finding people to qualify for their project, and those that do balk at the 30-year restriction. Also, the goal of the housing element document is to ensure high-quality living circumstances for all of its residents. The proposed inclusionary requirements will make Arroyo Grande undesirable to quality builders and developers. The cost of building will be falsely inflated, and neighbors will object more to the projects proposed. And number four, an effective housing element document should not rely solely on bonuses tied to density or concessions that compromise the viability of a project just to accomplish the inclusionary requirements. And number five, though organizations such as the Home Builders Association and the California Association of Realtors do support affordable housing, they do not support such drastic increases such as this. And number six, I understand that the goal is to adopt a new housing element document.
With Jasmine, only 26% would go to the city. So what's going to happen when you implement this law to current projects that are under an affordable housing agreement with such a difference? That's my question today. Anybody? Tim?
I think maybe we can take the question and subsequent to this meeting, perhaps it'll come out in further review. Thank you.
We'll say the 90% is not accurate.
Hi, my name is Bill Sedek. I am purchasing the property at 1136 Grand Avenue. I'm a very small developer. I'm not SNS. I don't have my own attorneys. I only have my wife as my spokesperson. My concern is that I am a rare breed, which is I'm not trying to get the maximum amount of buildings on the lot. I'm just trying to do a quality project. By lowering the affordable housing from 9 units to 6 units, that makes me very reluctant to put a lot of money, to put a lot of effort, to put a lot of quality in the project. I'd rather do a smaller project with an allowance of 10% affordable housing rather than being squeezed and being asked to produce 15%. Being asked to produce 15% affordable housing will leave me absolutely no choice but to be a cookie-cutter builder. And that's not what I'm trying to do. I am trying to do a quality project. I'm all for affordable housing. If it's reasonable, I'll comply with it, and I'll put a project that is going to be very pleasing to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? I think we got everybody, except you, Angela. Did you want to make a... No. Okay. All right, we will close the public hearing portion of this item and bring this back for discussion. Councilmember Guthrie, why don't you start us off here?
Well, we've been through this housing element quite a number of times. It seems like every time we come back, there's another state provision or something to deal with. I don't know how long... 1118 has been around, but it seems like it just came back on the horizon. I think that the biggest thing that we need to focus on here is that, in fact, we are attempting to meet the state's basic criteria for housing element. And one of the methods by which we're able to accomplish that is, in fact, going from the 10% to the 15%. That's what's driving that. We, in fact, in order to be in compliance, we need to produce a certain number of units. And in order to produce those units, this is the only method available to us. It's not the only method, but it's certainly the method we've chosen to do that. I do think we need to move forward here. I think there's a lot of unknowns here, but they're not just unknown for us. They're unknown for everybody. I do agree with every time that I think of this concession or incentive, I come up with an unfunded mandate. I have to agree with the mayor there that there's certainly the potential that there's some sort of an unfunded mandate here, or the concessions and incentives aren't nearly as onerous as we interpret them. They do refer throughout the law to, this is, I think they're kind of their out as far as the unfunded mandate, to a section of the Health and Safety Code basically saying that a concession or an incentive that violated these two codes in here, we wouldn't be required to meet. I tried to find this on the internet the other day, and I'll tell you, I couldn't find it on as simple a search as I couldn't find it. So I'm not quite sure what they're referring to, and I'm not sure that they're sure. I suspect that they put this together as a way as to develop their out, and then when the reality of the law comes in, as many of these laws do, then the law will either be unconstitutional or ineffective. I do think that there's some potential for the proportional share that the state has recommended here. I don't think that's why they put it in. I think they actually put it in to prevent one-time affordable housing, that a community would produce housing that actually would only be affordable through a single sale. And I think that's their intention, but it's actually not what I think that they've accomplished here. I think that if we see this exercised, we'll see one-time affordable housing with some return to the city to try to go out very quickly and produce another affordable house. Because who would sell their home, go through the trouble, the difficulty of finding a qualified buyer when they could simply put it on the open market, take their piece of the equity, and move on from there? So, but that depends on what their intention here is. If that's their intention, then it certainly then becomes a Trojan horse that all of the density bonuses and all of the incentives and in some cases still get the same density bonus. So I'm not quite as convinced that when builders actually look at this, that they'll necessarily see it the way Jerry does, and that they'll choose to develop as few affordable homes as possible, even if it means a smaller density bonus. But we'll have to see what people do going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This has been a long process, and I think the goal is that we need to adopt a housing element. We need to move this thing forward, and we need to be compliant. In my opinion, even though I have a lot of questions and concerns about SB 1818, there's not going to be one developer in this community that's going to take advantage of that, and that is because we have a building community, in my opinion, that does not want to build affordable housing. That's been my gripe since day one, and unless we require it and we put the appropriate ordinances, it will not happen. It actually irritates me when I have representatives from SNS Home coming up here and talking about affordable housing when that's what was promised. Berry Gardens has promised us affordable housing. Warren Sanders had the opportunity to put those on the market and make money, but he chose to make a lot of money. So that's how you get your attorney. You got to make a lot of money. But nonetheless, we didn't get any affordable housing out of Berry Gardens, and you know that. Unfortunately, we didn't have the criteria in place that we are planning to do now. And I think it's important for us to move forward with this particular ordinance. I think that if the state does come down and have mandates on not only the city of Arroyo Grande, but we're going to find that League of California Cities is not going to put up with having to provide incentives that are going to cause other impacts, such as parking and such as setbacks and conflicts and land use conflicts are going to be problems. And I think we're going to see that there may be actually some conflicts with CEQA. So nonetheless, with those comments, I think it's important that we move forward. I'd like to see I'm in support of the resolution. I don't think we're going to have a problem with SB 1818, in my opinion. I may be a little naive, but the way it's written, I'm certainly of the belief that the way I see it, it's going to be the concessions and incentives and the density bonuses are going to be over and above our inclusionary housing. So we'll see where it goes. Thanks.
Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I definitely agree with both the previous council members' statements. I'm constantly frustrated at the state that they continue to micromanage at the local level. I don't believe that we should have to grow at any rate other than what the citizens of Arroyo Grande want to grow at. But unfortunately, this is a requirement of the general plan that we have a housing element. I know a lot of work has gone into this document. Every time we make a change for the state, another curveball is thrown at us. Whether or not SB 1818 is really going to impact us or not, I'm not sure. Obviously, there's a lot of people in the room that aren't sure either. But I think that if we were to delay this to try to interpret that, the next thing we know that something else would come. So I'm in favor of going forward with this. I'd like to thank Kelly. I know she has done an incredible amount of work on this. I think I saw this for 2 years at Planning Commission, and now here we are at City Council. So great job. As best we can say great job on this, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We are here to either approve or not approve our housing plan, housing element, and we've gone come a long distance to get to this point. We've amended it to deal with the realities of SB 1818, and I don't know how much SB 1818 is going to affect us, but there's not a whole lot we can do about it. It's the law, and it's in place. There'll be some legal challenges, and that may change interpretations and such, but it's here we have to deal with it. And the housing element has been amended to include the provisions that we have to deal with. At this point, I see no reason not to go forward with adopting this. It's going to be nice to have a document that's been approved by the state. So I can support the adoption of this measure.
Could you do me a favor, Kelly? Earlier you read a statement, and I believe it was related to how we were going to include 1818 into the housing element. There was a caveat on there about environmental concerns. Do you remember which one you read? Process of drafting some substitute legislation, not only, I suspect, in light of SB 1818, but also they're attempting to redraft the entire housing legislation. And what they've come up with is once again, and I should indicate that representatives from the building industry are involved in that process. And so what they're attempting to do is reasonably, logically shift the locus of control back to local government so that we don't have top-down management from the state level mandating what we should and should not do with our communities. What I'm not clear on right now is the degree to which that bill has, or the draft, what its status is. I know that the League was looking for a sponsor, and I'm not sure if they were looking in the Assembly or the Senate for a sponsor, but I know that that they are diligently working on it. Obviously, the reality of it is that if it does go through, if it is successful, it won't engage until the next cycle, the next regional housing cycle. But I would like some clarification on where that is, what the status of it is, and also their interpretation of SB 1818 before I vote to approve this. And I'm not suggesting that we put it off forever, only until we find out or get some additional clarification on the League's position. They're a very valuable resource. They have a lot of expertise. They have a lot of subject matter experts working on this. And so the degree to which we can at least clear the air, we may come right back in, at the next meeting and decide that we're going to do exactly the same thing that we have here. But I would feel much more comfortable doing it that way. The other issue is, and I think since we have an opportunity, it's important to understand, it's important, I think, that our community understands just exactly what is happening at the state level. And yes, we have to acknowledge the fact that this is law, but here are some excerpts from the law that are spinning forth from the state of California on top of our city. And I just want to read a couple of these things. Cities and counties must grant more concessions or incentives, reducing development standards depending on the percentage of affordable units provided. Any project that meets the minimum criteria for the density bonus is entitled to one concession from the local government agency, increasing up to a maximum of three concessions. In other words, this is once again a game that we're playing. And it is, at least in my mind, when we start talking about, you know, the degree to which we do in fact have local control or should have local control, this is ludicrous. Waivers and modifications of development standards. A city or county may not impose a development standard that makes it infeasible to construct the housing development with the proposed density bonus. In addition to requesting incentives and concessions, applicants may request the waiver of an unlimited number of development standards by showing that the waivers are needed to make the project economically feasible. I think if you let that set in, you know, I've remarked several times about the fact that I felt the original housing legislation, the way it was written, was probably the worst piece of legislation I had ever written or read until I read this. And this is, at least it's equal. This is bad law. And any way you cut it. And it just ires me to no end that it just doesn't stop. So I am concerned. I'm a little comfortable, a little more comfortable, Kelly, with the way that you've drafted the paragraph that indicates that it's subject to environmental review per CEQA. But when you start looking at some of these concessions and what they really mean to circulation, to water, to schools, to all of the other infrastructure that we need to increase our housing density to make it work right in this community, it scares me. And so that's what...
And the one I'm looking at here is that the concession or incentive would have a specific adverse impact as defined in paragraph 2 of section 65589.5 upon public health and safety or the physical environment of the property. And I guess I'm hanging my hat on the fact that some of the regulations we have in place that people might want to have concessions on are going to be public health and safety issues, and we're not going to give concessions on public health and safety issues. So I share your concerns, Mr. Mayor, and I'm hoping that the interpretation of this is going to be a little bit more favorable in terms of public health and safety, and that this doesn't give carte blanche to a developer to have all of the development standards just waived.
Well, I think the nice thing about what I'm hearing coming out of the league is that we can make the determination when and where we provide the density, the affordability issue. There's also suitable locations, as was indicated, for much more of the type of a project that's a better fit for the community, as you described earlier. Those are all issues that are discussed in great detail in what we're hearing coming from the league. So anyway. I'll get off my soapbox, but those are my concerns, and I'm not comfortable moving ahead with anything that relates to SB 1818 until I get that clarification. If and when that clarification comes forth, then speaking for myself, I don't have an issue with going ahead with it as long as we have those caveats clearly delineated, specifically the environmental review aspect and what the Mayor Pro Tem indicated a minute ago. So that's my position.
Would the city prefer, if we were going to postpone this, date specific or date uncertain?
We're I don't think we have any objections of gathering some of that information. We're a little bit leery about any lengthy delay, because one of the reasons we'd like to go ahead is we want to get the new inclusionary requirements in place, because until those are in place, and if a project comes forward now, we're still applying the lower inclusionary requirements. So any project comes forward, we're going to get less affordable units from. So that's why we're anxious to at least get that component in. A delay of a meeting or so probably won't make any difference on that. So do you think we can get this back by the next meeting?
You know, we're talking about one meeting.
Okay.
And I can, if you like, I can make a call up there. I think I know some of the folks on the Housing Task Force, and at least get a name for you or a contact, or even I can ask where it's at. I didn't, you know, when I got the staff report, it was a little bit, there wasn't time with the holiday to make that phone call. But I did want to find out where they were with that substitute legislation, because it's certainly the direction that I think many of us in the community would like to go, including the home builders. So I would say one meeting if the council would indulge me on this.
So the answer to the question would be a date certain at the next meeting, if that's the direction that the full council wants to go.
If I may, Mr. Mayor, I don't have any trouble with a two-week delay. I'm not certain that I understand what difference it would make if, in fact, we knew that there was replacement legislation in the pipeline as far as the adoption of our element goes. Certainly, there might be some interpretation of SB 1818 out there, but I'm just wondering, and I'm certainly willing to wait 2 weeks to find out what other clarification we may get from the league. But I'm just not sure what difference it would make as far as the adoption of our element goes if there's some replacement legislation in place for SB 1818.
Well, specifically what I'm after for, Jim, is the SB 1818, and to the degree that it may, I'm not saying it will, but to the degree that it may result in us perhaps settling on some different wording on how we accept it into the housing element, That's my main concern. It may not, but I think it would be time well spent to do that small bit of research. This is an important document we're approving, and so I just want to make sure that we don't leave any stones unturned.
Would you like a motion, Mr. Mayor?
If there's no other comment... Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, council members. staff has been working recently to address the speed limit on Wasner Road. The speed limit is posted at 40 miles per hour from East Branch to the easterly city limits. And the posted limit has been questioned recently by a number of disputed citations. So Wasner Road is classified as a collector street, with two lanes in each direction, except for that portion of the road near the intersection of East Branch, which is four lanes.
Excuse me, is it one lane in each direction with that exception?
It's one lane in each direction
you
except
said two.
For... Oh, I'm sorry. One lane in each direction except for the intersection at the Wasner Road. I mean at East Branch. Let's see. The road width, of course, varies. There's a couple other things that are very, very unique to this particular street, including the residential access to the roadway. There's a park site, and there's also a senior mobile home park. We did an engineering and traffic survey. This was performed in accordance with the vehicle code and the Caltrans traffic manual. There are several factors that were used to develop the speed limit. Of course, there's the speed radar speed survey itself. There's a two-year collection of records for collision. There's stopping site distances, shoulder conditions, the street profile itself, the vertical and horizontal curves, and, of course, intersection spacing. Because of the existing street characteristics, we felt that the radar survey should be performed at two locations. We tried that, and in fact, we found that the survey indicated that there were two different separate speed zones. The first zone is from East Branch to Stagecoach, and the second being from Stagecoach to the easterly city limits. With the information that we collected from the engineering study, we had a meeting with the residents last week to review the results of the survey and to address any questions that they may have. Most of the comments that we did receive were centered around the location of the park site, the senior mobile home park, the site distance and visibilities for some of the connecting streets, the proximity to the school, and the residential access. One of the things that I wanted to read from the traffic manual itself was the actual definition, as this is something that we went over at the meeting. And this is from the traffic manual, the Caltrans traffic manual. And the statement in here regarding the prevailing wage, prevailing speeds, I don't know what subject we're on here, as determined by the manual, says that the prevailing speeds are determined by a speed zone survey, which we did. The guidelines for a speed zone survey include, and this is the intent of the speed measurement is to determine the actual speed of the unimpeded traffic. The speed of traffic should not be altered by concentrated law enforcement or other means just prior to or while taking the speed measurements. So what we tried to impress upon the residents was that it was the intent of the speed measure to determine the actual speed of unimpeded traffic. In addressing the concerns we discussed with the residents, we discussed all of their concerns at the meeting. There were some other follow-up things that we did, some investigations on site distance at the intersections. Although there was not a clear consensus among the residents, I think there was an understanding that there needs to be some posted speed limit that can be enforceable. And the way to do that is through the traffic survey that we did. As a result of the survey and discussions with the residents and the police department, we're recommending that a speed limit on Wasna be posted at 40 miles per hour from East Branch to Stagecoach and 45 miles per hour, which is a change to 5 miles an hour more than what it is now, from Stagecoach to the easterly city limits. I have a graphic up here to show the entire length of the section that we're talking about. And with that, Mr. Mayor, I'll conclude my report, and our police chief is here, and we're both available to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, are there questions for Don or the chief?
The results of that survey have been declared a speed trap by the court and are no longer enforceable. And that happened early last year. And we have not been enforcing speed violations out there for approximately a little over a year now.
So we have had a more recent speed survey than the 2001.
We recently did one.
Okay, that was the question I was getting. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes. Chief, the issue before us is the fact that at this point, it looks like the county court judge, I believe, has verified or has deemed this particular stretch of highway as being inappropriate to enforce at the 40 mile an hour speed limit.
Correct.
this issue came before us several years ago, and it was my understanding that we were working on trying to keep the speed limits down due to the unique, and again, I understand, but the unique situations due to site, due to the park, due to the senior housing, mobile home, so forth. Regardless of all that, we have a situation where it can't be enforceable. In your expertise in this area, let's say we were to move it to 45 miles an hour on this stretch of highway, we would then be able to then make it an appropriate, I mean, in other words, it's enforceable at that particular time. And typically, what is the practice of law enforcement in regards to ticketing? 5 miles over the 45, 10 miles, what?
It depends
on 1 mile?
It depends on the roadway. On a roadway where we're having trouble, it becomes a more narrow focus. It could be, for example, 5 miles an hour. On the normal roadway, it could be 10 miles an hour. So on a roadway like this that has some special conditions, we could focus it down to 5 miles an hour. I think the important thing to understand is right now the effective speed limit on that road is 55 miles an hour, and we wrote a ticket for 57 and a 55 about a month ago. And that's what our real problem is at this point in time. But as we were discussing earlier with some of the residents in the area, given some of the special situations, special circumstances on this stretch of roadway, we would narrow down our citation range, which would be about 5 miles an hour.
So really we're talking about people traveling at 50 miles an hour possibly and still being not enforceable, 48 let's say, and they're doing that type of speed limit adjacent to a park and a senior mobile home. Now I understand the difficulty, so let's say you're saying if we didn't restrict it, we couldn't enforce it, and now we have people going at 57. You clock someone doing 57. What is the average speed through there at this point? According to our the counts that we conducted, the average speeds through here at least the most current data that we have.
Are you speaking of the section?
I'm speaking of the section. Yeah, east of Stagecoach Road.
It was around 47, 48 miles per hour. That was the average speed. Yeah.
I also wanted to point out the area in front of the senior mobile home park is in the area that would still be 40 miles per hour. So that particular issue, we believe we were able to address by showing that the survey is at a lower level in that portion of the street.
I remember our last meeting, the comment, Chief, that you, correct me if I'm wrong, but the problem is that we can put up signs, again, to make them enforceable. It doesn't really, it's not going to change necessarily the behavior of folks driving down that road. They're still probably going to drive at the same average. Is that correct? If we were to, in other words, at what point do people start speeding when we start increasing the speed limit?
There is a misconception out there that every time you raise the speed limit, you're going to raise the average. And that's, when I say there's a perception out there of that. That doesn't always follow the course. Speed limits tend to take a level, and they tend to stay at that level. The biggest issue is whether we're taking the speed limits seriously and in.
Yes, I guess my feeling is one, the speed limit is one mechanism and probably the paramount mechanism that we use to try to regulate appropriate speeds on our roads. But there are other mechanisms out there, other safety. I mean, if we have other things that we need to look at on this stretch of road to provide for appropriate access, let's say, to our public community park, then we need to be looking at those things as well. Is there, for instance, a crosswalk across this particular stretch of road?
Correct, there is. And, again, it was a discussion we were having. I think if you're leading to the fact that, and this gets into budgeting and capital improvement programs and things like this, there are engineering things that can be done. There are certain types of traffic control devices. For example, I applied for a grant. The police department applied, or the city applied for a grant from the Office of Traffic Safety. We've been funded for lighted crosswalks. That crosswalk was one of the ones I was looking at. We found out later, because of the Office of Traffic Safety restrictions due to the federal funding issue, we couldn't put one of our newly funded lighted crosswalks out there because there's already federal money involved in that street. So we have been looking at some options. If we went to a lighted crosswalk, it would be something the city would have to fund through its capital improvement program. I think it would be beneficial, but again, it would have to go into the list, you know, of projects and be prioritized by the council.
Okay. So what I have to look at is what are the benefits and what are going to be the downfalls. Basically, if we move this up to 45, we're going to be able to ticket at 50. And right now, our average speeds are at 47, 48 anyways. So if we kept it at 40, I'm not sure, you know, are we going to make any differences with that? We wouldn't be able to enforce it. We could certainly, we could have a sign that says 40. We'd have a sign that says 25 down there. Can't enforce it, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So what other mechanisms? I think we need to look at the stretch of highway, and we're going to need to look at what kind of mechanisms. If we can't enforce the speeds based on our speed limit, if we're tied by the county courts to a 45 mile an hour speed limit, then what other mechanisms can we have on this stretch of road to ensure safety for not only the residents within that area, but for the folks, you know, that are visiting the park and so forth? To me, that this is going to be continue to be an issue. And as soon as my fear is that what happens if we set it at 45 and then the averages continue to go up, and then we have to change it again. We're moving in the wrong direction, in my opinion. So I guess some of the thoughts that I'm trying to figure out is maybe looking at the stretch of highway. If we need to put some of these mechanisms in our capital improvement program, then let's see what those costs are, and let's at least evaluate it. But and I know that's not a question, but some comments. So thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Any other questions, Mayor Pro Tem?
Very quickly. The speed of unimpeded traffic, I take it that already considers that we have crosswalks and special considerations. There's not much we can do about that without making physical improvements.
We looked at those considerations, and with the idea that we're trying to, or what the code requires us to do, measure the speed as impeded traffic, that's right. Those are the things that we can do right now.
Okay.
Without doing something physical to the roadway.
What's the speed limit once you reach the east end of town? It bumps to stays at 45?
It's 45 in the county.
Now, if we do the split the way it's proposed, so we have 40 miles an hour from the Y intersection to Stagecoach, then we'll have a stretch that will be remain 40, and we can enforce at 45 there. Five over would be 45, so we would be able to use that stretch of road to maybe slow some people down. And if word gets out, that will have a positive effect on that impact. And then we will continue to enforce at 50 and above from Stagecoach to the east end of town.
55, sir.
55. Or, you know, 10 above on that one. Okay, thank you. Well, and last question. Do you think that this is a positive step we can take at this time that will allow us to enforce this? This is a useful measure? I'm looking to the chief here on this one.
I'm glad I'm coming up on the end of my career. I think by adopting minimally tonight,
What was the criteria that the traffic judge ruled that it was that the 40 miles an hour was unenforceable, and why wouldn't they just follow the same ruling here on the last quarter mile or 200 yards?
Mainly, the new survey is a split survey, where the old survey was a single survey, and again, I probably should be letting the traffic engineer talk about this, but since I had talked to the traffic referee about this, I have a little bit of history with it. The old survey was a single survey out on Wasner Road, so the entire roadway was based upon that single survey. What has happened now is engineering has actually made two surveys. So we have a survey on the bus barn to Stagecoach, and we have a survey on Stagecoach to the city limits. That is legitimate. It would be legitimate to split the speed because you actually have a reasonable distance in either section. So there's not an issue because that survey that was taken between the bus barn and Stagecoach supports the 40 mile an hour speed limit. The other survey does not. And the original survey did not. The city tried to reduce it from a 45 down to a 40, and the court did not buy the arguments that the city presented in doing that, and that's how it was declared the speed trap.
Thank you.
I had just a couple quick questions. The comment that you made, Chief, about the potential for a lighted crosswalk out there, and I think the caveat was something about federal funding being used on the street. Seems to me that in a conversation I had with you, Steve, earlier, we had the same issue here in the village with the two locations that we wanted to put those kinds of crosswalks in. How does that differ from out there?
Yeah, actually, the village was the one location we found where we think it does qualify that we can use the money there. But there were several other. I think we'd looked at James Way, Traffic Way Grand. There was a number that fell into the same category that it is on this federal funding list. But apparently, the East Branch is not, and so that's the primary ones we're currently pursuing to use that grant money.
So the issue of federal funding became a non-issue in the village. It's not the way we originally thought. Is that what you're saying?
Correct, yeah. It was determined this was the one street that did appear to qualify for the grant.
Well, let me ask a question about the feasibility of not capital improvements, but something that perhaps is a little less intrusive, but could be just as effective, maybe, at least worth a try with not a lot of upfront money. What kind of latitude do we have out there with signage and also something like bots dots, particularly on the east to west traffic coming back from the lake? Because that's where I see when they cross into the city, I think that's where a big part of the problem lies. If we were to put some, perhaps, you know, some additional bots dot patterns out there or something like that, and then post the sign. I've seen signs in communities that say speed limit strictly enforced, you know, 45 miles an hour speed limit strictly enforced, or entering a residential area speed limit strictly enforced, something along those lines. How does that treat this situation?
As far as the physical placing of the dots on the road, I think there are some out there now, which we placed when we went from 45 from the county into 40 in the city. I think we could probably beef those up a little bit. We want to be careful we don't create a road hazard situation where we have too many of those things and they cause people to go off the road or other things. But we certainly can stagger them and place them so that, you know, we avoid some of those problems. As far as the signs go, we're able to put as many signs out as we want to. The the thing with signs is you have to be careful is that, you know, they'll see them the first couple of times, and then they'll, if you drive the street routinely, then signs become somewhat ineffective. But we're able to put as many as we want out there. We can make them as big as we need to and place them exactly where we would like them. So in that case, yes, we can put signs out there.
Well, yeah, granted. However, if the sign goes up and that says it's going to be strict, as is the practice, particularly on items such as these, we do allow members of the community to come forward and comment. If there is anyone in the audience who'd like to come forward and comment on 11A, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. We would ask that you hold your comments to 3 minutes or less. Anyone like to come forward?
I will. Thank you, Mayor, Council. I guess I was part of the first initial taking the speed limit down from 45 to 40, and it came well supported at that time, not knowing all these other definitions of speed codes and Caltrans manuals. Going back to 2001, Tom, can you tell me what that average speed was in 2001 on that strip? The first initial where we brought it down from 45 to 40, where that basis came from. In 2001, what was the average speed?
We got that from the radar survey that we did.
And what was that?
47 to 48.
In 2001 or 04?
2001.
Okay. So in 2004, it didn't change. It stayed at 47 miles an hour is what you're saying. So on that basis, how did we get to that point that we did lower it? Where did you come on the board that it was okay to lower it at that point? Where did you make that, you know, justification? Why did we pull it from 45 to 40? What factor?
Actually, this was his, but being perfectly blunt, I think we tried to apply some conditions that were subsequently dismissed by the court. If we would have maintained that at 45 miles an hour, we wouldn't be in the boat we're in right now. The fact that we lowered it to 40 miles an hour, when the court examined the speed survey, and the engineering study, the court did not find justification in lowering it to 40. It should have been at 45, and that's why it was declared the speed trap.
And so they didn't ever take into some of the special considerations that we found out now as far as the curve of the road, the driveways that enter that roadway. Those are irrelevant now to keep it at 40?
I think, again, I would have to go back like Don mentioned, but I think many of those were mentioned in the former speed survey to reduce that. And when the court took a look at that, they did not find they were applicable. They did not find the sight distances were applicable. They did not find the special conditions existed. And that's why he made his decision.
Okay, so going into that, so did they ever take into consideration how many vehicles of 45 feet and of over 10,000 pounds travel that roadway?
I have no idea.
It's part of a speed survey.
I can't even answer any of that.
It's part of a speed survey to decipher the difference between an automobile and what we have trailers and trucks. I mean, that would be a legitimate speed survey to separate the vehicles, because we do have vehicles of over 10,000 pounds traveling that speed trap at a certain speed that they can't even control their braking distance. Never took that into factor?
You know, I think at this point, if you wanted to state your position, that would help us, and then maybe perhaps an alternative might be for some of those concerns. It's clear that we've tried to influence the traffic commissioner or the traffic referee as to the special circumstances, and I think the chief has done that. It might serve everyone well if he were to hear it from some of the members of the community. That's an alternative. So what you might do is put some of your concerns into a compendium and submit it formally to the traffic commissioner. But if you have a stated position, that would help at this point.
Okay. Right now, my stated position would be stick with the 40 mile an hour and enforce it. And if, I mean, you guys can look up this in the DMV, 22.357.1, that can be enforced at 25 miles an hour in a certain area to be 25 miles an hour if it is posted. You can get that up. It's stated in there, and the local authority rides that. Now, you know, as we talked in there, that it could only be so far, but that space there is what, like you were saying, the boats and the trailers are coming into the city limits, they're moving. You know, whether we put a lighted crosswalk, whatever it takes to slow them down, I have kids, I have animals, that park is play, and that's all these kids know over there. They cross that very cautiously. And it's an unsafe environment out there right now. And it's unenforceable. Yeah, that probably is true. But I don't think that they've probably taken into the full consideration all the special conditions that are out there. And it has to do with that speed survey. And, you know, I hope that, you know, we go further in keeping it where it's an enforceable speed limit out there.
Speed bumps out at the crosswalk and people don't pay attention to them. I would like to see a lighted crosswalk out there. As an adult, I don't try to cross Wasna because you can be on a crosswalk. You're risking your own life. Cars will come buzzing by you so close that if you jump out of their way. So the signs, I think they're going to be totally ignored. The other thing I'd just like to say is with the housing going in the area, there are more children out there. I really think this is a public safety issue, and if it means that the city has to spend some money to put a crosswalk out there, a lighted crosswalk, I think that should be number one, is the public safety. And right now there is a major public safety issue with Wasna. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, excuse me, can I get the names of the speakers for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just...
Oh, your name, please?
Patty Welsh.
Dean Clark.
My name's Brian Talley, and I live at 1140 Vard Loomis Lane, just, I guess, a few hundred feet off of Wasna Road. And I'm good friends with Dean, and that's how I learned about this issue. And I really applaud the research that Dean has done on this issue. As I came here and sat in the back room with the chief of police and Don, I guess I've come to appreciate just how difficult this situation is that's facing you guys. I mean, my attitude when I got here was, let's, you know, do everything in your power to keep this thing at 40 miles an hour. But now I guess I feel differently. What I would really like to see is lighted crosswalks at to the park. We have crosswalks there. It sounds like there's an issue about whether or not those can be funded with a federal grant. Well, if they can't, then by golly, as far as I'm concerned, the city ought to pay for it, because it's an extremely dangerous situation. I echo Patty's comment that this, you know, of all of the things that you guys have been talking about tonight, this is a public safety issue, and somebody could be killed out there. So I think I've said my piece, and my position very clearly is that I think there should be lighted crosswalks out there. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, and seeing no one, we'll close comment on this and bring this back. Who hasn't started? I think everybody has. Jim, you want to go?
Yeah. Chief, if I could ask one more question. In regards to, let's hypothetically say that we were to put in some signage, and hypothetically, and I know this costs money, but we put in some lighted crosswalk and put in some of those mechanisms. And let's hypothetically say that that actually reduced the traffic speeds for a period of time, and then we went out and did another survey, and that survey showed that the average speeds were in the 42 mile an hour range. At that point, would that then provide the justification to then drop the speed limit back down and be enforceable?
It's actually a question for the engineer officially, but yes, you could.
Because the speed limits that we are posting are part of it's a formula that has to be used, and it's based on 80% of the, I mean, it's complicated, but Don, maybe you can address that. But in other words, if we had average speeds that were lower, we could then post it lower. Is that correct?
And that has happened on rare occasion. Let me do hopefully a Reader's Digest version of where we're at with all of this. Unfortunately, we have a state criteria that's imposed by state law that is applicable equally to every city regardless of situation. We all know every community is different. We all know there are sections in each community that's different. However, the state, several years back, because of, I think, probably some unethical conduct by many communities using traffic enforcement as a revenue source, passed some very strict laws. And when they first did that, they allowed the communities to set their own evaluation criteria. And then some communities started playing games with that. And they amended the law that everybody has to use the Caltrans criteria. I think we all know the Caltrans criteria is not always the best criteria to apply within a city. But the fact is,
by the book. But I guess what I would like to recommend is looking at mechanisms that could actually, like the mayor talked about, possibly focus on having people reduce their speeds, and then maybe we go back out there and do another survey and just see what happens, and we might be able to move it in a different direction. My fear right now is we're moving in the wrong direction, because if we up the speed limit, I know, you know, I'm going to have to approve that at this particular time. But if we don't put in other mechanisms, my fear is that next time it's going to be even higher, because people just start to take off. They're going out to Lopez, they're doing what they want, or they're coming back, and I think we really want to try to move this line that's currently at Stagecoach out further out to the city limits, but that would be my hope. So with those comments, I would certainly understand, I hope that the folks in the audience understand the dilemma that we're in. In order to enforce this stretch of road, I think it's imperative that we're going to need to go ahead and change it to 45. When we were here a couple years ago, we tried to put in those mechanisms. The traffic, within the traffic counts, I believe that we cited all the reasons for keeping it below the 85th percentile or whatever, and that didn't work. So without going directly to the source, to the folks that are making these decisions, we're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. But we can allocate city dollars and look at how we can maybe make some improvements to other improvements that can maybe help slow the traffic down in this particular area. And I would support the consideration this evening, but I'd also direct staff to come back with some other alternatives that might help reduce the speed in this particular area. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Chief, I have one question for you also. I had talked to one of your motorbike officers in my neighborhood. They were ticketing one day, and when the guys were going by at 28, 29, I asked, 25 mile an hour speed limit, and he said, I can't ticket under 30 because the judges will kick them. And I just wanted to clarify that, because, you know, there was some mention of why don't you ticket at 46, and I kind of think I know the answer, but I wanted to make sure I did.
That's correct. In fact, there's a term for that I really can't say publicly that the judges call it. But the factor, they want to see about a 5-mile spread. We were able to successfully, because it hasn't totally gone through the system yet, we were able to deal with this other one in the 55, because the court was sensitive to the fact that this is not a good situation out there. They're sensitive to the fact that it is legally a 55 mile an hour speed limit, even though it should be at least 45 lower, granted. But so when we wrote that ticket, the officer did that knowing full well that it could be kicked by the court but we think we've been successful with it because there is a sensitivity by the court that that is a very excessive speed out there. So this was a special situation.
And I also wanted to address your mentioning of the, if the survey had been done during the summer and the speeds had actually been higher, we could be looking at a 50-mile-an-hour speed limit out there. So if the survey was done during a time when the speeds were actually a little below normal, we've actually benefited from that. So I definitely understand your concern, but I don't see where anyone benefits from us continuing to have a 40-mile-an-hour in the section that's completely unenforceable. As much as it might make you feel good to see it, if we're going to be completely handcuffed from doing anything until it exceeds 55 and quite questionably maybe to 60, I don't think anybody wants to see that either. So I would definitely be willing to look at trying to find ways to slow people down legally. But I also would like to make sure that we have a speed limit that will allow us to actually ticket speeders instead of as they do learn the speed, or just even if they don't learn and they're going through your neighborhood at 55. I know personally when we were having a problem with a lot of construction on our street and we asked for the speed to be monitored, and when the cars were going by at 27, I was upset because I know completely what it's like and you're going, that's speeding. I mean, you should be going 25 here as far as I was concerned. And so I understand the sensitivity totally on the speed, but I don't want to see us do nothing and then you just continue to be more frustrated. The other comment that I would like to ask Steve, I know we had discussed the lighted crosswalks, and one of the concerns that the city has right now about crosswalks where there are no
improvement to the safety of the crosswalk that we already have. But, and as I understand, at Strother Park there is a crosswalk there available. So I think that's what we're talking about is lighting an existing crosswalk.
And I realize that, but my question is, right now, with it not being lighted, people at least are aware that they may or may not be seen. And so there's maybe extra care taken by them. Whereas my concern is if we put a lighted crosswalk in, will we be giving them a false sense of security that because it's lighted now, that they're, I don't want to say more invincible, but basically that people will see them quicker. And since the speed limits are considerably higher there, that the risk actually could be increased by crossing a lighted crosswalk there.
Well, I think that risk is involved with any crosswalk. In fact, since it's lighted, at least there is a more likelihood that folks will see them. But I think that the chief, chief's really our expert on the crosswalks. He probably can add more to this.
Actually, the way the lighted crosswalks are usually put up in intersections or at crosswalks where there is a significant problem, and people are aware of that. And there can be signage that goes along with that, that this is here to enhance your safety, you know, still be cautious and all that. The lighted cross, there are a couple different styles out there. The one style is the one you kind of see in San Luis Obispo, which is the small LEDs. The other style is the one you may see in Pismo Beach, which you can see from about a half mile away when it lights up, and that's the style I would be recommending because it sticks out like a sore thumb. I mean, people will see it, it's flashing, it gets your attention day or night. If you've seen that one again in Pismo, that's the style, and I think that would significantly add a dimension of safety to what I call an unprotected crosswalk. As the city manager alluded to, actually under the code, the chief is responsible for putting in crosswalks and things like that. And I've taken a position that unless it's at a controlled intersection or we have some type of significant control, I just won't put one in, authorize it to be put in. And again, that's a safety purpose. But in this case, we're trying to remedy an existing situation. And the one system, I think, is a very, very good system and would be much better than what we have out there now.
Thank you. With that, Mr. Mayor, I will be supporting this tonight. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
Yeah, I'll be supporting this tonight as well. I do think we probably should look at some other measures as well. I do think given the speed that people are going, I'm not quite as convinced that a lighted crosswalk is going to slow people down that much. I think we probably have to look at a number of possible alternatives here. I do know that I go through those ones at Pismo fairly often, and they're visible, but they're not. They're by no means the first thing you notice, and of course they're not in a particularly. It's a busy area, but nobody's going with any speed at that point. It's a fairly unique situation to have a crosswalk sitting out, basically almost at a freeway off ramp. I mean, people are in fact traveling in a down a road that has almost no cross traffic until they get into the city. So I think that's what we're dealing with here is the fact that we have crosswalks sitting basically out in the middle of nowhere out there as far as traffic is concerned. So I think it's going to take more than simply lighting the crosswalk to slow people down, but if that might be a first step, or we might look at some other alternatives. But I do think we have to support the 45 miles so that we can enforce the law that we've got. I do think we should be taking a look at redoing the survey and continuing to follow this to see what happens in the future. Thanks.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Again, let's go back to what we're doing tonight. We're looking at a resolution to establish speed limits on Wasna Road. This is a partial solution, and only a partial solution, to a very critical problem we have out there, a public safety issue and a life safety issue. I support the concept of going 40 miles on the stretch from the barn to Stagecoach and 45 from Stagecoach to the edge of the city. But I think that this is just the first step we need to take, and it is just the first step. We need to examine potential for a lighted crosswalk. We need to examine any and all possible measures that we might be able to take out there. Let's look at what's out there that we can do to try and slow traffic down, to reestablish some control over this. If we can get people to slow down as they enter the city to a more reasonable facsimile of 45 miles an hour, that's great. But we must look towards establishing a safe area around that crosswalk, particularly around the crosswalk. And let's try to get the traffic speeds down. Let's redo the study. And if we can gradually bring it down a notch at a time, let's do so. But this is the first step, and let's not consider it the last. Let's look at the other measures we've got out there, and we'll determine what's appropriate, determine what it's going to cost. We'll figure out how we're going to pay for it.
Stopped. And I think we need to look at the technology and look at what's out there. I think probably the Pismo approach is might be a little bit of overkill, because we do have some residents on the north side of the street, and I'm not sure I know those lights are shaded, but. You know, I don't think anyone wants a lighthouse beam shining through their window every time a pedestrian stands in the crosswalk there. But I think the technology is out there for us to sort of select a system that works, whether we go with a vertical sign that flashes or just the in-pavement lights. We can find something that would work out there. If there are federal funding restrictions, then I would strongly recommend, and I hope it's in the motion, that we fund this some other way. I don't know if it's traffic impact fees or what other vehicle we have, funding mechanism we have available. But clearly, the onus is up to us in terms of where we go from here. I agree with the comments in terms of us being sort of handcuffed. Poor choice of words, I guess, with regard to the speed enforcement. And so it's a difficult sort of reverse rationale to get a hold of, but that's unfortunately what we're dealing with here. As far as the other strategies, I would also like us to consider looking at a dot pattern out there in such a way that it complies with the requirements for spacing. But I think particularly for people who are pulling boats or are in RVs, those things are no fun to go over repeatedly, and it certainly gets your attention. And also the alternative signing. I hope that's part of our comprehensive approach that we indicated as well. And again, we've seen many examples of those in certain communities, something along the lines, as I mentioned earlier, you're entering a residential area, speed limit strictly enforced.
And then, of course, the other piece of the comprehensive program would be the actual enforcement. If we're going to go to the trouble of putting up, again, all of these warning signs, and we have to deliver. Another strategy that I would like to see us follow through on, and I'm not sure it's going to do anything or not, Chief, but at least we can go on record, and I would strongly recommend that the city draft a letter, if we've not already done so, to the traffic commissioner or traffic referee, explaining the unique circumstances that exist on Wasner Road. If it does nothing more than put the city of Arroyo Grande on the record that this is not exactly suitable for a one-size-fits-all policy, namely the Caltrans criteria. So what we need to do is formally request, I think, that we have perhaps some relief from the Caltrans criteria. And I know you and I talked about, because I brought up the park as well, I was appalled that there can be no special circumstances granted for a neighborhood park. But that's the case. And then the other thing that I would recommend, and we have absolutely no control over this, this is certainly up to you folks that have spoken this evening, but I truly believe that if there was also something forthcoming from a group of concerned residents out there that was addressed to the traffic referee as well, put that together with what we hopefully will send from the city, that now the community and the city is on record that this is a unique circumstance and perhaps doesn't fit into the singular policy that we've been forced to go along with. So all I can do is suggest that. It'd be up to you to decide whether you want to do that. So those are my comments. I would be willing to support staff's recommendation with the approach that I described and has been described by my colleagues. So, motion?
Yes. I'd like to make a motion to adopt a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande establishing the speed limits on Wasner Road and also for staff to study traffic calming devices near Struthers Park, including but not limited to lighted crosswalks, traffic dots, and extra signage.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that, but I'll also...
As brief as possible. I would like to take just a few moments to discuss a few of the key points of this report. First, the general fund balance for June 30, 2005 is projected to be approximately 16% of appropriations. While this is below the City Council goal of 20%, it was anticipated by staff and is primarily due to the City's required contribution of approximately $244,000 towards the state budget deficit. It is projected that the City's fund balance will be impacted over the next 2 years due to the requirements to assist the state. However, this shortfall will be recovered in fiscal year 2006 and 07 when the state reimburses the city for the motor vehicle license fees that were not received during fiscal year 2003-2004. Next, it is important to note that due to the implementation of the triple flip legislation, it is hard to compare the current fiscal year with prior fiscal years. Under the triple flip legislation, 0.25% of sales tax revenue that previously went to cities was given to the state. This is the first flip of the triple flip. For the City of Arroyo Grande, this amounts to approximately $761,000. The second flip requires counties to reimburse the cities for the lost sales tax with property tax that were designated for schools. The third flip is when the property taxes designated for schools is reimbursed by the state general fund. In addition to the triple flip, the state reduced the amount of vehicle license fees paid to the cities and replaced the VLF backfill with property taxes. The City of Arroyo Grande's portion of this VLF adjustment is approximately $885,000. These reimbursements will be received twice a year, half in February and half in May. Sales tax and VLF revenues are down a combined total of $250,000 compared to the prior fiscal year due to the state adjustments just mentioned. Finally, as of this report, the city had only received 32% of the budgeted property taxes. There are two reasons for this decrease. First, the city had not received the first half of the state-mandated property tax reimbursement, which amounts to $823,000. Second, due to a timing issue, the city received December property tax revenue of approximately $544,000 in January of 2005. In past fiscal years, the city has received these large payments in December. I will end this report now and be happy to answer any questions that you may have at this time.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on the report? No? No questions? I'm glad you ended the report when you did. I don't know if we could handle any more of the news. Any member of the audience? Don't think any member of the audience is going to be forthcoming on this. So we'll bring this back for comments and action. And Councilmember Guthrie, why don't you start this?
Well, I know when we first look at these numbers, they're pretty scary looking, but I do realize, and I'm glad that you were able to clarify that on the property tax in particular, that it really is a timing issue rather than a misbudgeted. I mean, I tried to add that really quick, that there's about $1.2 million in revenue that really should have appeared in the first half of the year, but based on the cash flow rather than the actual amounts due, that in fact those would be included here and would change this picture quite a bit. I will compliment staff on really great cost controls. I mean, I realize there are always some overages here, but overall I think we're showing great cost control in a really tough time. And actually I'm pretty comfortable that most of the revenues will in fact come in fairly close, and I just think we're probably lucky to be able to make the 16% given the constraints that we're under. So I'm happy with the report, but I do understand with the way that it lays out that I'm comfortable going forward that we are in fact going to finish within budget and don't need to make any changes going forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Dickens?
I have nothing else to add, Mr. Mayor. I think that the fiscal situation is going to be a little up and down due to the state budget and what they've done to us. We've known that, so we're going to work through the next couple of years until we create some stability. So appreciate the information. Thanks.
Okay, Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mayor. Yeah, I'd like to just commend staff also on really containing the costs as best you can. I had the same concern that Jim had initially but when you answered the explanation for him, I definitely understand it better now too. So nice job. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you. And thank you, Angela and staff, for the report. In these uncertain fiscal times, it's important to have this kind of information in a timely fashion, and just keep it coming, and we'll deal with the problems as we can. And I have no problem supporting the approving the adjustments and recommendations in Schedule A through E and approving the request for additional appropriations in the fund as you've recommended.
Maintain the level of service and also maintain our fiscal viability here. It's, I think, a tribute to the way the city is managed, and particularly from a fiscal standpoint. So, again, these are not the best of times, but we're certainly making the best of a bad situation, and that happens as a result of good planning. So I appreciate that. With that, I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I move we approve the detailed budget adjustments and recommendations as shown in Schedule B, as well as approving Schedules A through E that are included in the mid-year budget status report, and we approve the request for additional appropriations in the general fund as submitted.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem, Vice Chair Costello?
Yes.
Council Board Member Dickens?
Yes.
Council Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Council Board Member Arnold?
Yes.
And Mayor Chair Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. That takes us to item 12, City Council Reports. I'll go first. Slocog. A lot of administrative items that occurred at our last meeting. Mostly what we're talking about, I guess what we're listening to at the board meetings is more bad news with regard to our transportation and transit funding.
So for us here in San Luis Obispo, or in, yeah, San Luis Obispo County, there's a the manifestation of what's happening is a direct impact on projects that were in the queue for both study reports and environmental review and design. And so for us, that has meaning in terms of two key intersections. One is Briscoe and one is El Campo. And I'm sure you're probably well aware of it by now, but those processing of those projects is ceased. And until funding is restored in some form or another, those will not proceed. And I think the best estimation we're looking on Briscoe is 2008. And El Campo, unfortunately, if we're going to use STIP money, extends beyond that. So it is not a rosy picture. And we sort of sigh with relief whenever we hear good news every time we go to a SLOCOG meeting. South County SAN, I've attended two meetings, I think, since the last report. Again, a lot of administrative and maintenance issues have come up. There is a rather important item that will surface probably not the next meeting, but the meeting afterwards will be a public meeting, and more than likely it will relate to the status of the sanitation district in the Zone 1, 1A assessments for Arroyo Grande Creek, the flood control area. So that's a very dicey situation, and but I can't share anything more right now and won't be able to until we get ready for our public meeting. Aside from that, under the other category, I recently attended a mayor's meeting, and Morro Bay hosted it, and just some things that came up. Assemblyman Blakesley was there again and had some additional information on some legislation that he was going to sponsor, and I'm sure when we have our meeting with him, he'll share some of that with us. I continue to be very impressed with the way in which he has postured himself in relation to some of these committees, because the committee work that he is involved with can do nothing but help us here in San Luis Obispo County. So I'm encouraged with the progress that he's making in Sacramento. There were some other things that came out of the League of Cities Channel Counties e-board meeting that I shared with the rest of the mayors. And I think what I'll do is put that in writing and just give it to Steve, and you can distribute it's things like how we determine we're going to host Channel County's meetings and that sort of thing. And then also some fundraising issues that are going to come at us probably in August. San Luis Obispo County and all of the cities will be hosting a fairly ambitious fundraising event. And that will be with a view towards generating revenue to support the Channel County's portion of the contribution to the local group, foundation, or whatever, to ensure that we continue
budget process. On the other issues, we met last week for the Fire Department Oversight Committee. And things continue to go very well in the cooperative venture we have with the city of Grover Beach. The chief was able to report that the training is continuing to improve, and for both separate departments that are functioning as one. We've had excellent participation with the community of Oceano and their fire department. They have expressed a desire to become involved. There had been some reluctance expressed at the last meeting that they were finding it difficult to match up their times to meet with us and train with us. They've overcome that, and they are participating quite successfully. We also talked about the potential that the city of Pismo Beach has asked to be included in the study, and we will be going forward and looking at that. But all in all, the experience we're having right now with Grover Beach has been a very positive one and continues to improve the efficiency for both departments. And I'm very pleased that it's a success, and I look forward to it continuing to be so. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Mr. Mayor, mine will be also very brief. I did attend the February 16th meeting of the South County's Area Transit. Primarily, we went over budget assumptions, and I guess the biggest thing that we reviewed was an item presented by the City of Grover Beach based on their Ramona Gardens Community and Cultural Specific Plan. And the SCATS was really looking at just providing them some approval of the transportation improvements for that particular specific plan. But there's some interesting things that the City of Grover is proposing. That was pretty much it. We decided that we would change our meetings to quarterly, and I think that covers the SCAP meeting. I also attended the January 27th South County Youth Coalition meeting, and primarily there was a presentation surrounded around the First Five funding program, which is a monies that have been available, basically looking at preschool. And that's an implementation program that's taking place in Oceano. It doesn't directly affect us, but it's just some good information. So with that concludes my report.
Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
Yeah, the EDC meets tomorrow, so I don't have an additional report from the one I gave to last month.
You get the award for the most brief, most brevity here. Okay. Councilmember Arnold.
Ditto.
You just lost. This new champion over here. Okay, that takes us to item 13, City Council member items. Any this evening? Says none. So, City Manager items?
None, sir.
Okay. Council communications? Any council communication? I will mention one thing. I had an opportunity this afternoon to go to the Zone 1-1A meeting. You can well imagine what the topic was. Everyone is concerned about the DWR work plan that was forthcoming on the Arroyo Grande Creek. This was created by the relinquishment of control of the channel by the county to the state. Their budget for maintenance, forming the maintenance district, is very severe. So there were other alternatives that were discussed, and again, more to follow on this, particularly as it relates to the sand district. Okay. Staff communications? Any this evening, Steve?
Thank you, Mayor. Just a couple quick reminders. Tomorrow, the Rotary Bandstand Project is having a groundbreaking at noon, and everybody's invited. And then at 2 o'clock, there's a dedication of the new Police Community Outreach Center at the Five Cities Center. And then lastly, the mayor mentioned the meeting with Assemblyman Blakesley, which has been scheduled for April 1st at 3 o'clock. And the meeting will be somewhat informal, but if you do have specific issues that you'd like us to put on an agenda and make sure that they get brought up, I wanted to encourage you to provide me an email, let me know, and we can prepare a little list of topics that we might want to make sure that we bring up at that meeting.
Okay. It takes us to item 17. This is our final community comments and suggestions. Mr. Ross, anything tonight? Okay. We'll close that. Takes us to item 18, motion to adjourn.
So moved.